and those commissions are formed two ways. One is under the general statute, 576.051, or named in the statute. So when you do 576.051, you get all commodity commissions formed under that statute, which is one of the fire commission.
Okay. Thank you very much. So you are comfortable with the DAS file?
Very.
Okay, thank you. My intention today is to move the DAS-2 and DAS-5 and DAS-3 amendments into the bill and then hold the bill for future work and negotiation. So since we're in work session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I move the DAS-2 amendments into House Bill 2648.
Colleagues, we have a motion before us to move the DAS-2 amendments into House Bill 2648. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Yes.
Yes. Kevin, you please call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Beck?
No.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Hedlund?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Manning? Aye. Representative Piercy? Excuse. Representative Starr? Aye. Representative Wells? Excuse. Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Kirsten?
Aye.
Thank you. And the
DAS
2 amendments are moved into House Bill
2648. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Move the DAS 3 amendments into House Bill 2648.
Colleagues, have a motion for us to move the DAS 3 amendments into House Bill 2648. Any discussion? Is there any objection?
This is one bill I just, in principle, I cannot support very anything to do.
Mr. Wells, could you please call the roll?
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Beck?
No.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Manning?
Aye.
Representative Piercy?
Excuse.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Welch?
Excuse.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Kirsten?
Aye. And the DAS-3 amendments are moved into House Bill 2648. The motion on the DAS-5 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the DAS-5 amendments into House Bill 2648.
Colleagues, have a motion before us to move the DAS-5 amendments into House Bill 2648. Any discussion? Yes. Mr. Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be voting for this amendment as I did for the other two amendments, but if this was to come to a work session today on the overall bill, I would vote against the bill in third motive for the minority report. No negotiations are going on, but that's the current status of my vote on the bill.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's duly noted, and I respect your position here today.
And I'd just like to say, Mr. Chair, I would probably join him on that.
I understand that. Thank you. Mr. Chamoff, we did get some advice on the from an individual here, Mr. Beverly, from the Fire Commission. They are comfortable with the DAS-5 amendments. Mr. Wells, could you call the roll on the amending any DAS-5 amendments?
Representative
Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Beck?
No.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Manning?
Aye.
Representative Piercy?
Excuse.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Welch?
Excuse.
Kirsten.
Aye. We have the bill amended, and we will bring it back for further work session if necessary. I will close the work session on House Bill 2648. We have before us couple bills we had posted previously.
Yes.
And we'd like to call up, open up a public hearing on 2930 and 3053 concurrently. And I'll do that. And Mr. Moore, please give us a rundown on these two bills.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2930. I require fiscal sampling of signatures on state initiative or reform petition submitted to include original signatures. Issues discussed at the previous meeting on this issue, a burden on the county clerk, reporting requirements, changes needed in the initiative process. Given specifically judiciary order changes, process clarification changes, and policy changes. There was involvement in discussion of the Attorney General and Supreme Court, and he discussed the ballot title measures. There's been a difference of opinion among citizens, legislators, and other branches of government when it comes to what is appropriate for verification of signatures. House Bill 3053 requires fiscal sampling of signatures from the state initiative referendum petition submitted, modifies requirements for political contribution and expenditure reports filed by candidates and political action. And the same issues were discussed related to that bill.
Mr. Phelps. And Larry Bevin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roy Phelps, and with me is Larry Bevin. Larry and I worked in the Electric Division for 10 years together in 1977 to 1986. I'm here representing Oregonians to maintain community standards, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 48. And we are here in support of these measures. The measure I'm probably addressing mostly is House Bill 3053.
There was another bill also you wanted to address today.
Yes, sir, I did, and that is not posted, but it's House Bill 3557, which I'll make a reference to as we go along.
Thank you.
The passage of House Bill 3053 and House Bill 3557 will prevent future occurrences of the unfortunate situation that happens to the folks for whom I work, specifically the placement on the general election ballot of an initiative measure that did not have the Constitution required number of signatures. In 1998, Larry and I determined and reported to the Secretary of State that an initiative measure that the Secretary would be certifying to the official ballot did not contain the Constitution required number of signatures. The Secretary did not examine or review the information we had prepared to demonstrate the signature shortfall, but did indicate that he would check with have his deputy check with the Attorney General. We were later told that the deputy that the Attorney General had advised that there was no authority for the Secretary of State to not act by moving or certifying the measure to the ballot. And frankly, this is at odds with advice that I had received when I was in that office, where several assistant attorney generals had indicated to me that if a public official has the authority to act under the law, they also have the authority to reverse that action if it's wrong. The Secretary of State certified the measure containing 99,865 valid signatures of voters. Our efforts established that there were at most 95,301 valid signatures. Hence, the Secretary's certification overstated by 4,564 the actual number of valid signatures on the petition, and further overstated by 2,380 the valid number of signatures required by the Oregon Constitution. The practical effect of this action had on the thousands of people who were opposed to this measure, and for whom most of whom I work, was a needless expenditure of $4.2 million to defeat the passage of the measure. That did not include the amount of money that was spent on the verification process as well as attorney fees. The initial rejection of 13,866 signatures from the original filing of 117,056, this was a very high rejection rate at the outset of the process. Nothing was done, and yet 13,866 signatures were rejected, a rate of around 12%. Overall rejection in the 15-18% range is considered normal, and right out of the chute, you're darn near there and you haven't done a thing. The two-step process for selection of the actual signature to be verified by the county officials is taken at one time. Our opinion is that should not have been done. The second sample should have been taken after the deadline for submission of additional signatures, and that becomes a point later on. County election officials rejected 25% of the signatures, and this is the highest rate of rejection for the whole 1998 election cycle. Later, I believe on the deadline for filing, 29,688 signatures were brought in by the petitioner, and the second submittal signatures were selected for verification by county election officials. These signatures never merged with the first batch of signatures, which I believe is what the statute calls for when it says there will be two samples. This, in effect, became the third sample. The true number of duplicate signatures on a petition is not determined by the Secretary of State. This has been the practice since the sampling process started in 1974, and one of the reasons Mr. Evans is here is he was part of that startup. He was at the Secretary of State's office from 1966 until sometime in the early 1992. One of the things we're seeking is that there be a individual duplication rate determined for each and every petition. The state of Washington has one. It has a process by which they do that. The first batch of signatures would have a high rate of duplicate signatures since paper petition circulators had the petitions out for a long period of time. The second batch of signatures would also have a high rate of duplicate signatures. In this case, approximately one half of those signatures were gathered in two counties, Jackson and Multnomah. Returning to these two counties with paper circulators for additional signatures indicated to me and Larry that there was a high probability the same person would sign more than one time. 35%, which is the graph bar to the far right, you're right, was the overall rejection rate when you start out adding in the 13,000 plus that was started with. That is a very high rate of rejection. The fact of the matter is, I don't recall in experience where we had anything that high. In summary, we believe this petition did not have the constitutional required number of signatures, given the high rejection rate at the start of the process, the highest rejection rate after signature verification by county election officials, and the substantial number of signatures gathered in a short period of time. I asked Larry Dubbins to help me develop the information needed to demonstrate this initial petition did not have the constitutional required number of signatures. Larry developed the methodology that's described in the chart now before you. We also had the assistance of former election managers Edna Lippard from Marin County and Heidi Olmsted from Benton and Linn counties, and Larry and I, and we actually compared signature by signature of multiple same name people on various signature sheets. And what we did is we developed a database that simply, as you'll see in the materials you have before you, called out just simply for the information about the petition, what page number, what line number, the name, first and last name, and then Thank you. So then, when we met with the Secretary of State in late August, we had evaluated four counties that we had selected since the signatures gathered represented a half, as I mentioned to you earlier. The results of this examination showed that there was a signature duplication rate of 5.66%, not the 2% duplication factor used by the state. And I would like to point out right now that the 2% duplication factor has been in existence since the initiation of this signature verification process. And I believe it needed to be looked at probably after we began to have paid signature circulators. And I'm not here to talk about that because, frankly, that process is in place, it's going forward, and I believe that's the way the law is, and so that's not our issue. The point is that there are folks who get motivated to have names on signature sheets, and I'll show you some of that in a minute, after they have
same chart.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Then your
blue book handout.
Blue book right here. Okay. That's a little hard to read. After meeting with the Secretary, we decided to examine all of the sheets, all of the signatures on multiple same name people on the signature sheet submitted for this measure. The results of this examination showed that there were 7,606 signatures of the same name people on signature sheets submitted for this petition. Leave that chart up, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This chart shows the breakdown of counties as a result of that work, and that's this chart you have here. You will notice in the third column over, you have, let's start from the beginning. You have 103,190 signatures in the first submittal. If you apply the 2% duplication factor, you should have 2,064 duplicates. We, in fact, counted 5,627. Moving across, you have the second submittal, the 30,000, which projects to 602 duplicates, and we identified 260. You add together the 5627 and the 260, you do not get to 7,606. What you have not been able, what was not identified, but was identified through our process was that between the first group and the second group, 1,719 people in the second group were duplicates from the first group. And unless you put them together, you never find that out because they stand alone. So that's where it was important that we actually made the effort to look through both groups, keeping them separate, but crossing over. Now, if you could, Phil. In one instance, which I think is probably the most outrageous, is we have one person who signed twice on the same petition sheet. Third down from the top and second up from the bottom. This, I believe, and then there's another chart that Phil put up, please. That shows here, in this instance, and this is a person that actually signed the petition 16 times. But in this particular example, at the top, you have the same name at one address and the same name at a different address. One of the reasons we didn't put the addresses in the database that we developed was if we wanted to look at the signatures. That was more work, but also we were able to identify people who may have moved and felt that they might be okay to sign a second time since they are at a new address. This person, however, got carried away, and your blue book material will show that she, in fact, the second to the last page in Multnomah County, the person signed 16 times. I guess she just fell in love with it. And several times, the signatures were on the same day. I believe this legislation is badly needed to prevent the placement of measures originated through the initiative process that do not contain the proper number of signatures. We are prepared to work with the committee to prepare the appropriate amendments needed to clarify the policy intended by this legislative proposal. We believe that the legislation should direct the Elections Division to perform only two samples. And I remember when that particular statute was enacted. And what it was to overcome a frustration a person has when they're not successful with the first sample and they want to add additional signatures and they bring those in. Prior to that time, there was no process for that, and frankly, I think turned down at least one person. And so the legislation was intended to do one sample and only do a second sample if there's additional signatures or you're about to reject it. If the alternative, you want to allow for the second, and I understand the practicality, and you have a measure in 4U to give the secretary more time for signature verification, and I believe some of this was promoted by, some of the problem I'm having was promoted by that chart window. And we've testified that we think that's a great idea. Having said that, there should be only one set of initiative petition sheets from which any sample is taken, whether it's the first one, the second one, or whatever. Otherwise, you never find the duplications between the first group and the second group or the third group or whatever that number happens to be. And that's my second point. Well, if you would. Because if you'll notice on this chart, the first sample showed the name of that individual, and that same individual is signed on that second sample. So between the two samples, you have the same individual signing twice. As a matter of fact, the dual signature is also the signature of the circulator. Other thing that would be very beneficial to the process is if you were to have, in Hospital 2001, you have a provision, or calling out for a provision to have a central voter registration system in the Secretary of State's office. It would go a long way to pick this up. Right now, it would be a fairly hard undertaking to make this kind of comparison. It can be done, but it's difficult. The other measure, the one I like, House Bill 3557, is an instance where if the all else fails and the people who want to know whether or not the measure should or should not absolutely be on the ballot, those persons ought to be able to pay and have the entire petition verified at their expense. And that can be done either after the fact or before the fact. And I'm flexible on when that can be done. I realize 3557 is not before you, so I'm not going to say more. That's our presentation, Mr. Chair, and I'll be happy to answer any questions, or Mr. Bevins, who actually started this whole thing.
Thank you very much. If in the case of requesting that the entire petition be verified, it would be a fairly time-consuming task.
Yes, sir.
And the deadlines and such to need to get on the ballot, that turns a fairly significant public policy decision.
It does, but as the bill describes, you can actually, according to the policy proposal, you can actually hire persons to do it. You can come up with an electronic verification process and really shrink down on what it is you want to look at. You're not trying to verify every signature. What you're trying to do is you're trying to find out whether or not you got duplicates. And so consequently, that can be accomplished in a much shorter period of time. So I know from personal experience it can be done in about 3 weeks.
And the other two binders we have before us are...
Well, you're familiar with the term high grading. I've given you a representation, as best I can, of the various kinds of duplicates that I found in the representative county in the state of Oregon. And I've got the summaries in the front, and this particular is also in your blue book. But the summary is right here in the front of the first volume, and you can go through and you can actually see how we did it.
Okay. President Manning.
Mr. Chairman, this is less in the way of a question rather than in support of testimony from me as to the other side of the spectrum. You've heard testimony here about one particular petition where the 2% rule, as we'll call it, was favorable to the petitioners because the actual number of duplication, at least as alleged or found in the study, exceeded 2%. As to measure 61, the other end of the spectrum appears because after all the controversy was over about whether or not measure 61 could be made certified, we put all of the signatures into a computer and the necessary information and ran them and found a little over 1.5% duplication rate from all the sheets, which in our case, not being a 2% duplication rate, would have meant that we should have achieved ballot certification status of measure 61. My recollection, and I'm going to be careful about saying my recollection, is the Secretary of State's own actual duplication rate, as I've heard it, was about 1.56%. Now, that was something that somebody passed on to me. There's no official record of that. And I know Colleen Seelock will say there's nothing out there, but some little birdie suggested that to me at one point. Let's just say there's no official record of that. Those of us who were proponents did put all the information, all the signatures into a computer, and we ran them. Again, this is after the fact. In our information, there was just over 1.5% duplication. And so we would have suffered at the other end of the spectrum where we were so close that this could have gotten us over the line. What these bills would do, at least in part, would be to say, look, let's look at the duplication rate for that petition. Otherwise, the system presently would reward someone who is sloppy, at least if you have a rule that assumes a certain duplication rate, based on some samples from the past. But why bother going through your petitions trying to clean them up and remove duplication because you're ahead of the game if you have a sloppier duplication. So I certainly support the concept in the bills, and I understand from earlier conversations there'll be some technical language suggestions about using proper statistical language, both as to the discussion of which samples are drawn on one petition when you have multiple submissions, as well as how you run the statistical sample. And I have no objection to using the correct language. My main theme here would be, let's just be real about each petition and use that petition as its own sampling base for what the participation rate is, rather than assume by rule that there's some standard duplication rate.
Okay. Well, how large of a sample would you use to determine duplication rate for an individual petition?
Colleen Seelock, who has expertise in this matter, will be testifying from her perspective. My understanding is that, I'll just let her testify because I don't want to mischaracterize it, but you actually do not need an extraordinarily large sample in order to do that. We'll hear from them what the real figures are. It may be that the current sampling is sufficient. I'd like to find out myself, and I don't know if Mr. Phelps has an answer from his own expertise in that.
Mr. Chair, I don't. All I have is the administrative rule from the state of Washington that, in fact, prescribes a process, statistical process, that does establish the duplication rate for each and every petition. As a matter of fact, using the numbers I had in talking with Mr. Whiting in Washington, and he was a little bit skittish or jittery about it because he said, I haven't got everything, but if you give me your numbers, he put them in to his formula, and he came pretty darn close to what I had, what Larry and I had developed from just going one by one by one through the process. If I could have the indulgence of the committee, I'd like to just demonstrate how this is done electronically. If you look at this summary sheet, there's the first name, Cooper, and you'll notice there's four signatures. What we did is we took and we identified the county and submittal number one. There was no second submittal in this case. Second submittal would be the second batch, the 29 or 30,000. The next thing we did is we took the actual number off of the signature sheet, which is a number that's introduced by, I don't know if it's the Secretary of State or petitioner, but it individually identifies each and every sheet. Then the next thing we did is we took the line number, that whatever line number that name appears on, and we took the last name and first name. All we wanted to do was get a quick snapshot of duplicates. We didn't want to get circulators, although in the summary I do give you the circulators' names, which I think you might find interesting. And we did not put addresses in there. And the reason we didn't do those two things was we were in a hurry. We wanted to quickly identify more than one a person's name that's on the petition more than one time. That was our goal. And then we went through an individual identified. And that's what this sheet has done. And that process can be accomplished how long, Larry?
Mr. Chairman, it took us 4 days to capture all of the signatures that we were given from the Secretary of State's office. And to produce these lists.
And then if you have that central file, you see how it begins to fit together. Like you can't, but you just cannot have one duplication rate, and you have to deal with all the signatures together. Otherwise, you don't have that set to work from.
Further questions from the committee? Mr. Evans, just testify.
Mr. Chairman, I was here to respond to any questions or support raised. He needed any particular support, which it appears he did not. But thank you for your
knowledge. Mr. Evans valued to me into this exercise is the fact that he was there when the whole process started in 1974, so I thought it would be a valuable asset, and he and I are available to the committee to assist in any way he finds appropriate.
Thank you very much. Colleen Seelock and Dave Thomas.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, my name is Colin Seelock. I'm the Oregon Director of Elections. With me is Dr. Dave Thomas. He is a professor emeritus of statistics from the Oregon State University. We thought what we would do today is we would quickly go through some of the points and at least attempt to respond to some of Mr. Kelp's presentation, which was very well done and appears persuasive on its face. But we always know there are two sides to every situation. As Mr. Post described, they did do a very detailed review of the situation. That information was used in Marion County Circuit Court when the unions and the clients of Mr. Post filed litigation against us. The court considered all that information, both the presentation that you heard today, as well as the response by the state. Much of the state's response was reiterated in the judge's letter opinion that denied the union's motion for summary judgment. I will try to structure my remarks, hopefully in the same order that Mr. Phelps made his. The state did use the correct two-step process in May and June, with the final sample completed in July. We believe that ORS 250-105 sub 3 requires the secretary to make a determination and review that determination for the chief petitioners on an early submittal. We believe determination is the same thing, and our attorneys have consistently advised us, at least in my tenure of office for the last eight years, that we must complete two samplings on those early submissions before we advise the chief petitioners whether or not they have ballot status or they do not. Anything less than completing those two samples before advising the chief petitioner of the secretary's determination would not comply with Oregon law. Anything less than completing two samples would penalize chief petitioners who would have successfully gathered enough signatures based on the two-step process but failed on the first step. If you as a body want to change that to the process that Mr. Phelps suggested, then you also make sure and amend Chapter 250-105 sub 3 that you define determination clearly, that this is either a preliminary determination or a one-step determination, because we believe right now we are held to two steps in that first review. The implied extraordinarily high rate of invalid signatures of 25% was not unique, and this was not the first time it occurred. In 1994, we had a petition that made it to the ballot with an invalid rate of 33.6%. And indeed, in 1996, the highest invalid rate was at 27.9%, almost 3% higher than the petition issue here, and it was sponsored by the unions here today, and it dealt with collective bargaining. So it is not unusual to see a petition rate these days that carries with it a 20 to 25, 26% rate of invalidity.
That was in 1994. You had one that was
1994, we had one that was 33.6%. In 1996, we actually had three that were higher than 20%. And in 1998, this last year, we had four of them that were higher than 20%. The window of time available and the reference that when the Secretary of State knows that there was an error made, they can reverse their decision. We have been advised by the Attorney General and clearly Marion County Circuit Court on page 3 of their letter opinion stated, the Secretary has no continuing authority to reconsider his verification decisions after the 15-day window expires. The Secretary of State, by Constitution, has 15 days in which to make this decision. So although the work the union began was presented to the Secretary of State, there was no action that he could take. And indeed, the Marion County Circuit Court reiterated that in its ruling. Research on the duplication rate. The research they presented is very thorough to the level at which they had taken it. We, of course, believe that there should have been some additional checks, which neither they had time nor would we have had time to do, obviously given the timelines. I believe that not all the counties were entered into the union database, or at least from the remarks and the handouts that Mr. Folks responded, that there are still some counties that are not in that database, so there is still some potential for an estimate. Now, I may have misunderstood that. But we do know that there was no check against county registration records to ensure that what they believed were duplicate signatures were actual duplicates, that they aren't fathers and sons who have similar names, similar, the same addresses, but similar handwriting or other relatives of close initials. We will be the first to tell you that that would be a very minute part, but when you're starting to talk about specificity or degrees here, that needs to be there. On more than one occasion, clerks have canceled voters only to find out that it is a father and son living at the same address with very similar writing. In addition, the next step that the state would have had to take, and if they could have considered this information, would have been to run the duplicate names that they gathered against the random selected names that we had already selected and sent out to counties to verify. The reason for that is because it would not be fair nor statistically accurate to subtract the name twice. So if one of the duplicate names that they were trying to remove from the total number submitted had been randomly selected and had been removed from the returns because they weren't registered to vote, or people could not, maybe they registered later and so their name was invalid, you have to make sure that those don't match. So that's another step. And again, the Marion County Circuit Court was specific in its agreement with the state on that issue when it said there is no evidence as to whether some or all of those duplicates were outside of the group of valid signatures relied on by the secretary. So you would have to build that additional step in. Again, there was not time for that.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. If I may interrupt, I think we're less interested in fighting the battle of a matter that's being fought in court than we are in looking at the conceptual issue as to how we deal with this in the future. I certainly would not want to challenge the good faith efforts of the Secretary of State of the Elections Division. I'm simply interested in helping us fashion some new approach for the future that might be more precise.
Chair Simmons?
You are getting there, aren't you?
I am. In fact, there was only one more line I had. So your timing was perfect, Representative Mannix. In fact, the only purpose that we wanted to respond was just to clearly make a record if someone used this hearing in a later date in some sort of a court trial. So regarding exactly where we were going, I would like to move on to what we were working on with respect to the duplication factor. We did test the duplication factor in 1993 and again in 1997. What we're looking at is a way to improve our current formula in the given timeline that we have. Now, clearly, there are bills out there that are suggesting, hoping that we can move to the voters that will expand that deadline. That, of course, if they're successful, then expands the options that we have. What we have here, and I will ask at some point for Dr. Thomas to also clarify some of this, I think you have his testimony before you as well, that we would recommend retaining the two-sample approach, again, recognizing that if you want to go the direction that Mr. Phelps is suggesting, you have to alter some of the language about what you do in the preliminary check. But the most important part of the new approach would be we now have all the counties in a position where they can specifically track all the valid duplicate signatures that they find throughout the entire sampling process. Now, on face value, you would think that would be pretty easy, but it is not always that easy when we're dealing with a 15-day timeline and the number of signatures we're looking at. But we now have that capability in all counties. Those specific real duplicate numbers of validly registered voters would be reported to us for purposes of calculation if the petition does not qualify on the smaller first sample. But the first step we would retain sampling 1,000 signatures, and we would assume a duplication rate of 8%, moving that 2 to 8. That's based on research that Dr. Thomas has done in specifically Washington. He's worked quite closely with Washington, but we've also reviewed numbers available from California and Arizona. What this high rate would do on the first sample would allow us to continue to process initiatives that have excessive number of signatures coming in with a high enough duplication rate that when we qualify for the petition or qualify the petition for the ballot on the first sample, that there should not be a question about how it qualifies. On the second sample, in order to specifically estimate the duplication rate, we need to sample at least 5% of the signatures submitted. So the second sample would now vary in size. It would no longer be an additional 4,000. It would vary according to the number of signatures that were submitted. So that mathematically, when you combine the first sample and the second sample, it will equal 5% of the total numbers submitted. We, from that then, would gather the real valid duplication numbers, the ones that the clerks have been recording, and we would then estimate the total number of duplications found in that specific initiative so that we would be accomplishing exactly what I think we're all here in total agreement about, that we need to improve the process in which we handle these. It will benefit some folks, and it will benefit some chief petitioners, and it may not benefit other chief petitioners, but who it does benefit is every Oregonian. This approach, we believe, although it will certainly add more signatures into the mix, because we now see petitions coming in with 150,000 signatures. If they went to a second sample, it would be a relatively large sample. Representative Mannix, I did want to clarify you for you. When we discussed duplication rate regarding ballot measure 61, we were doing what if a duplication rate in your petition. We do not look at duplication rates. There is absolutely no way that we could have ever tested for duplication rate in your or any other petition. That's the two bills that are directly in front of you, House Bill 2930 and House Bill 3053. 2930 and lines 20 through 23 in House Bill 3053 talks about the sampling approach of making sure that when you get a second batch of signatures in, that you are indeed taking signatures from both batches. Currently, for the first batch, and I'm going to use round figures here just simply because it's easier for all of us to track, I believe. Let's assume the first batch of signatures turned in is 100,000. We would test the first 1,000 and then another 4,000 because of what we believe had been advised that the current law is. That gives us a combined sample of 5,000 or a 1 in 20 probability that any signature would be selected. Then a second batch comes in a month later, and in that batch is 20,000 additional signatures. We then would select at the same rate, at the same percentage, at the same probability, 1 in 20. That means we would select from that second batch 1,000 signatures. With our new method of duplication, no longer assigning just a flat rate, but since that petition has already gone to a second sample, we would be estimating a specific rate for that. We would also carry forward those duplication names to the second batch. And so we would be covering the duplication from the first testing through to the second testing. Because currently we don't test for duplication, that has never been done. Under this new method, it would be. Under the proposed language of the bill, what you're suggesting is that you would run the first sample, you would run the second sample, and then you would do the second batch. If you add those second batch signatures, the new 20,000, back into the 95,000 that weren't sampled in the first batch, your probability of selecting a signature from the second batch, where you've heard testimony that tells you that there's probably a higher duplication rate, maybe higher invalidity, will rise to 1 in 115. And we don't believe that's statistically accurate. And Dr. Thomas can explain more about that. We recommend that you stay with the current rate of sampling, where you do a first and second review on the first batch. You do, if additional signatures are submitted, then you continue the second sampling at the same rate that you did the earlier mathematical proportion. Lastly, and I'll be brief because I know you have a long day, we would request some recommended languages on lines 18 and 19 of House Bill 3063 to reflect the duplication process that I talked about earlier. We would recommend that the Secretary shall determine a statistical signature duplication rate for each petition where a second sample is required, not in all, but in everyone that goes to the second. The Secretary shall not adopt a single statistical signature duplication rate to be applied to striking all petitions and substituting in the equation to the second sample. We do believe our new duplication approach will be stronger, more statistically accurate, and most importantly, will reassure the public that our sampling process is the most reliable possible. We, like Mr. Phelps, would be more than happy to work with a work group to hammer this out. I would also like to give Dr. Thomas an opportunity to speak, if you'd like to hear from him, regarding some of the equations that are used, some of the research he's done. Dr. Thomas worked very closely with Dr. Lyle Calvin. Dr. Lyle Calvin was the head of the statistics department at OSU, who worked with Larry Bevins all those many years ago when the formula was first devised. And so we feel that we have the same historical perspective, at least from a statistical viewpoint, that others bring to this table. So I can answer questions. Dr. Thomas, please. We both can just answer questions, given the time and some of the complexity.
Any questions with me at this point? Yes, Mr. Manning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I appreciate the testimony. I also appreciate the fact that we do have Mr. Thomas's analysis both on 2930 and 3053 in writing, which is very helpful. And I certainly don't ask that he duplicate that. I would wonder if it wouldn't be a good idea then to take the changes that we're talking about as to the statistical sampling approach, if we could come up with some Greek language and put all of that into 2930 as the bill relating to statistical sampling, and then save 3053 if we wish for other issues that are raised in that bill, which can be addressed separately. I'm just wondering what the issue of the chair might be on.
Well, my inclination is to appoint yourself and maybe one or two others on the committee to sit down and discuss what changes might be necessary. And
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a
further
question.
Mr. Thomas?
My name is Dave Thomas, retired professor of statistics from Oregon State. I still reside in Dallas. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'll just comment on some of the testimony that Wayne Seelock made. Concerning the duplication, we agree that we should not assume the same duplication rates for every petition. But also, we want to retain the first small, relatively small sample size of 1,000. So remember, the purpose of that is to eliminate unnecessary verification. In petitions which clearly have enough, even with a conservatively high assumption of an 8% duplication rate. So with the 1,000 verified, if you can eliminate those so that only the remaining ones need to have more verification, then you can allocate the verification effort to the ones that are more close call. So I think it was a very good idea to do this two-stage procedure. The problem is that you cannot estimate duplication based on 1,000. I put an illustrative example in here. If you sample 1,000 out of 100,000, the probability that you will catch a pair of signatures in your sample is 1 over 100 times 1 over 100, approximately. 1 in 10,000. So what happens is rarely will you see a duplication. But if you do, you subtract 10,000. And nobody's going to want to subtract 10,000. I have an example in here with the 100,000. Suppose 3% are duplicates of valid signatures. So there's 3,000 valid signatures which are duplicated. And about 3/4 of those samples, well, the probability about 3/4 that you won't see a duplicate in your sample. Then when you see one, as I remarked, you subtract 10,000. Increasing the sample size has a very dramatic effect on how well you can estimate the number of duplicates. So if you have 5% or 5,000 out of 100, then the probability that you draw an individual signature is 1 over 20. Probability you draw a pair is 1 over 400. So it's gone from 10,000 to 400. And we don't want to drop below 400. That is, the way you think of this is each pair that you see in your sample represents 400 in the petition, including the one that you see. So for that reason, we need to have a relatively large sample size to estimate duplication. Well, the 8%, I've been in close contact with Washington. They have shared duplication statistics with us for 13 fully verified petitions. Only 4 of those had the details of how many times there were 3 signatures of the same person or 4. Their petitions are typically about 200,000, so out of about 800,000, there was only one case where one person signed 12 times, one registered voter. And the next highest was 4 times. So that's all the data that we have on complete verification. Regarding the 2 batches, from the statistician's point of view, all the verification efforts that you're going to do in the first batch, you use it. Why say that for later? That is, you're making an important decision after the first batch as to whether it qualifies or not. So why hold back 4,000 signatures to be verified later? I was trying to think of reasons for this, and I thought perhaps it was the perception that you cannot estimate duplication between batches unless you have just one sample. But that's not true. You can take separate, independent samples from each batch, and you can estimate the number of duplicates between batches as well as within.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thomas. And I think what we'll do is allow two members to go ahead and proceed with the work group, and then you can bring us back and convince us with all the mathematics.
Thank you very much.
Representative Williams?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Mr. Thomas for coming today, and along with providing me some very helpful information, it kind of took me down memory lane and reminded me how pleased I was when I passed my only high college statistics class I had to take. Committed that I'd never want to look at another formula like that. So I appreciate you for taking me down memory lane, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you. I was afraid when you looked at that, you might think I forgot I was not in the classroom.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Kiesling. Secretary Kiesling.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee. Unlike Representative Simmons, I never had the pleasure to take a statistics class. Perhaps I should have, but I've learned far more about statistics in this job than I ever thought I would. I just wanted to speak very briefly to 3053 and a piece of it, which is very different from the statistical sampling issue that others have addressed. As written, House Bill 3053 addresses two very, very different issues. The first, of course, is the signature verification process, and I know we've been working with members of the committee, Representative Mannix and others about dealing with this, and I, for one, think that we've very much come out of this with a better process as we move into the future, even working within the 15 days if that's what it ends up with. But I do want to speak in opposition to the second half of 3053, which I think is bad policy about campaign finance disclosure. It would eliminate statutory requirements that now exist to provide, in addition to contributor name, an address and then an occupation / employer on campaign finance reports. Without this information, the public cannot specifically identify contributors or determine even the location of a candidate of a given name, in-state, out-of-state, what part of the state, etc. I also think that the occupation or employer, and of course some states require both, we give people the choice of one or the other, are both important disclosure requirements. In fact, they're in place throughout the country. Looked through the other 50 states, and this is preliminary, but it's our belief that if 3053 were to pass, we would end up having less disclosure than all but two other states, Mississippi and Wyoming. The public has been asked to address campaign finance reform several times at the ballot box. They have overwhelmingly approved it whenever they have gone there. Those bills, of course, have been ruled unconstitutional in whole, Measure 6 from 1994, or part, Measure 9 in 1994. But they're clearly concerned. People do not believe the process belongs to them. They believe that too much belongs to people who just simply have big resources. So, in that sense, I consider these aspects the equivalent to the wrong-way Corrigan of contribution and expenditure issues, 180 degrees away from where we ought to be looking, rolling back what current financial disclosures we have. And I want to point out that since we don't have any limits whatsoever, the court has said no to that, disclosure is about all that we do have. I think Oregonians are interested in finance reform. I hope we get a chance to fully debate some issues, including some controversial issues about some other approaches to that. This is an effort to debate one side of that equation, which is to do less. I hope we have a chance in future date to debate how to do things differently. That, of course, Mr. Chair, is up to you in this committee. But I did want to say that I am strongly opposed to 3053, this aspect of it, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Mr.
Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In agreement with portion of your testimony, but I thought that you might have some information, and if you don't, I know that your staff could find it. The level at which we start to require full disclosure of all of those items is at $50.01. How does that compare to other states, and do you know how long we've had that standard in place? I mean, if the standard's been in place at $50.01 since 1973 or something, maybe we could look at readjusting it.
Chair Chairman, Representative Devlin, it has been in place for quite a while. I cannot tell you how many other states have 50. I think some states have a higher threshold, others may have lower. But maybe Colleen can help me with when it's been in effect. It's certainly been in effect throughout my tenure as Secretary of State. And in terms of inflation and the like, it has changed in terms of value. $50 does a lot less far than it arguably did 10 or 20 years ago.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Devlin.
Mr. Keeson, would you have the same objection if we were to raise the amount to, say, $100.01?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, I think I'd be open to that discussion. I also might want to urge the committee to look at electronic filing as well. I mean, there's issues of filing the levels and the thresholds is one issue. We have come forward with urging that candidates, that we raise the limit for the non-reporting. You know, now it's 500, and you can do a non-reporting. We've urged it go to 2,000. But there's also the issue of timeliness as well. And, for example, on the Senate side, we introduced a bill that would require electronic filing above a certain threshold so people would have access to the information more quickly than they might now in an easier way. So you might throw that into the mix as well. But I have no objection to exploring to this committee other ways to do it. I just think this particular approach represents a wrong way to do that. Thank you very much.
Is there a minute?
Yes, thank you. I'm curious as to what your perspective might be as to the right of privacy of citizens in this state. We want to encourage people to participate in the process, and one might say that at some point, which is what we're in the government suggesting, at some point one might be so influenced by a certain contribution level that everybody ought to know who you are, where you work, and what your address is. But at the other end of the spectrum, how do we encourage citizens to participate in the political process and make some small contribution where they can have, never have a hope of inappropriately influencing a candidate, where they also have the expectation that their name and address will be published along with their occupation, which, by the way, under the current system is also an invitation to have every other candidate who wants to use that as a resource list to send them letters asking them to contribute to other causes. Is there some level where you'd say that the person has a sufficient interest in privacy and we want to encourage their participation? I've heard a $100 level suggested. It seems to me that even at $250 or $500, no person is going to have such an undue influence that they need to give up their privacy.
Representative Simmons, members of the committee, it's a good question. Obviously, the legislature has to weigh those competing interests, and you have the interest of personal interest in privacy weighed against the interest of the larger public in terms of disclosure. Now, those have been legal issues. The courts have held fairly consistently that the public has a right to know that they've left it at work.
I wasn't asking for what a legal interpretation would be. I'm looking for a policy.
Yeah. And I think that once the legislature prescribes a threshold for a reporter, it ought to have the level of information in that reporting that would allow people to identify interests that that person might have. For example, out of 150 people who contributed to a campaign, are 125 of them from a single employer or occupational group that would help the public understand where a particular candidate was getting support. So I think Representative Devlin's question is the better place to go, which is should the threshold be adjusted, but once you identify people, I believe that is good public policy to give sufficient information that people can then say this person, what might motivate this person in terms of contributing. Note also, of course, that whatever limits you do decide, below that limit, there is, in effect, anonymity. The legislature, in fact, made a policy call that $50 or less in a cycle for a legislative candidate will guarantee you anonymity in that process for purposes of reporting.
Well, it's just a minute. What about graduated level reporting? For instance, anonymity up to $100. If you give up the $250, at that point, we'll require your name. If you give up to $500, we'll require that your address be reported. If you give up to $1,000, then we want to know where you work. I'm trying to, in other words, graduated levels of privacy is stripped away as there's graduated levels of contribution level base.
Chair Simmons, Director Manning, I don't like that.
It
does have a little bit of, it does have, gives me some pause for reflection, and as you increase your contribution and your participation in the process, the perceived amount of influence you're going to have by the general public goes up. And along with that is a greater desire to know who it was. Any further questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Kiesling, we've talked a little bit about this before a few weeks ago, but I'm just interested in your thoughts in general. Are you at all concerned that the recent Buckley decision with respect to initiative petitions may be direction the court may be moving about disclosure of personal information and campaign involvement overall?
Representative Manick actually very wisely steered me away from offering legal opinions on the previous question, and
you reserve those to the Attorney General.
Yeah, obviously the Buckley decision has potential to reach a number of issues, including that issue of anonymity, and we also know that on the expenditure side, the court has made some decisions about anonymous speech in publishing and the disclaimer law. But contribution information has been consistently upheld, and until a court says otherwise, we believe that laws like this are constitutional, and that the real issue for this body is where you set those thresholds and the kinds of information. And I think in fairness to Representative Mannix's question, before any issues of how you enforcement issues as you kind of gradually strip away the veil and how you got to aggregate that information, so I want to move from one category to the next. I think in terms of simplification for an already complicated system, that we should just set the threshold and then provide that information. Simply saying name is in the middle ground where I don't think either purpose gets accomplished, either if you believe there is an anonymity guaranteed or disclosure.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kiesling. Further questions from the committee?
Thank you.
We have no one else signed up to testify on House Bill 3053 or House Bill 2930. Is anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify? Okay, now we will close the public hearing on 3053 and 2930, and Mr. Mack will be getting back to you about the future work on those two bills.
Thank you.
We do have House Bill 2989 scheduled just for a tap hearing, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2989, and I trust there's no one here to sign up to talk about it. And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2989. It has a nice relating clause.
It's got a great relating clause.
It has a great relating clause. It certainly does. Then we have HCR 70, and I do intend to recess for dinner. I hope you'll do that at 5. And we're coming right up on it. So what we will do is be back here at 6 and proceed on from there. So we've got to get to a number of bills yet this evening. How many people are here to testify on HR 70?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would ask, out of deference for some of the folks that have probably traveled here to testify, I'd ask that the committee maybe
you bring the name
of the for
you have it here.
Okay. I'd be willing to stick around for a while, too.
Me too. I have to leave at 5:30.
You what?
No one has traveled more than 100 miles, but what's your name?
Diana.
And you're not regular lobbyists. Why don't you come on up and give us your thoughts, and I'll open a public hearing on HCR 70. The lobbyists can wait till after dinner. Yeah, give us a staff summary. I'll let these folks who let the lobby wait, and then those who are after dinner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, HCR 70. First, the People Amendment to the Oregon Constitution will prohibit Oregon State Lottery from operating video lottery games defying Lotto and Very Mutual, and video lottery games. HCR 70 prohibits state lottery from operating any video lottery games. gambling has become an acceptable and regular part of our society. Winning lottery numbers are growing live on television. Odds on sports events, results of horse and dog races, and advertising for casinos are carried daily in our newspapers, billboards, TV, and radio ads all communicate the availability of gambling. Occasionally there are ads or posters announcing a hotline number to call for help with the gambling problem. There are few activities that have seen more growth in this country over the past several years than gambling. New opportunities to gamble are created daily. Most people who gamble will lose money. The odds are always against winning. Even though many people know someone who has won at gambling, people need to expect that they will lose more often than they will win. The benefits from gambling are to be found in excitement of taking a chance, the thrill of winning, and the fun of being with friends while gambling. Rarely is the benefit a financial gain. Choosing to gamble or not to gamble is a personal choice for which each person is responsible. Some people choose not to gamble in any form for a variety of reasons. Some non-gamblers are morally opposed to gambling. Some think it's simply foolish, while others may have a family history of gambling problems and they just don't want to take the risk. For other people, gambling is an enjoyable social activity that is done with family or friends for a limited amount of time. People who choose not to gamble or gamble with predetermined and set the limits are at low risk of becoming compulsive gamblers. But for others, gambling becomes uncontrollable and is no longer a choice. Compulsive or pathological gambling is not a bad habit, but rather a life-threatening disorder. Compulsive or pathological gambling is destructive to families, friends, and careers. Bills go unpaid, basic needs like money for food and rent are neglected, some gamblers become suicidal. The American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, Edition 3, revised in 1987, describes pathological gambling as follows. Quote, the essential features of this disorder are a chronic and progressive failure to resist impulses to gamble and gambling behavior which compromises, disrupts, or damages personal, family, or vocational pursuits. The gambling preoccupation, urge, and activity increase during periods of stress. Problems that arise as a result of the gambling lead to increase in frantic gambling behavior. Characteristic problems include extensive indebtedness and consequent defaults on debts and other financial responsibilities, disrupt family relations, interactions to work, and financially motivated illegal activities to pay for gambling, end quote.
Well, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Diana Haseman. I'm interested in this because I have a son that committed suicide in July of 95 because of video poker. We can't do anything for Bob, but there's thousands of people out there like Bob. We talk to them all the time. We're getting calls. And we need to do something, like give the people of Oregon a right to vote yes or no on this. We never were given that right. And I think that we'll find that they'll vote it out because video poker has been so addictive. Every person I've talked to has been addicted to video poker and none of the other games. And I'm sure it would be like slots. That would be as bad or worse than what video poker is. But we need to think about the Oregonians, you know, out there now. And I know that people don't want taxes to go up, but there's got to be a better way of doing things than stripping wonderful people of their dignity and their money and everything else. So that's why we're into this.
Thank you very much. Do you respect that file, also?
Yes. My name is Shonda Hardesty, and I'm Bob's sister. And Chair Simmons and the members of the committee, I just thank you for this opportunity to speak. I think it's so important to come up so that people have the option to speak and say what they think is going on in their state. I want to just start. I always start by saying that I'm here because my brother isn't. He took his life due to video poker, and I know that the money is a big part of the video poker brings in a lot of money for the state, but that's putting a price on my brother's life that I don't think it's okay for the state to do. I think it's very important that people realize that the money that's going into the machines and the money that these people are playing with is money that they don't necessarily have. In hearing what you just read, Representative Mark, so important, I think, that people realize how truthful what you said is and the importance of stripping what each gambler has from them, stripping their pride and their dignity. He removed himself from the family. He quit coming to family functions and he eventually took his life. that is something that the lottery has done to us, and I think that it's everybody's responsibility now to look and decide how we want to run our state and what kind of money we want to run our state. And personally, my brother's life wasn't worth the money that the state's bringing in. Like my mom said, we've talked to gamblers every day, and every day it's the same story over and over again. It's not, I realize that people need to be responsible for their addiction and they need to be responsible for the way they're spending their money, but it becomes not a choice. It becomes something that they don't want to do, rather they have to do, and it's because of that addiction. We, as a family, have started educating others. We've been speaking at colleges and different places to make sure that people realize that it's not that we're out there to say we don't think that everybody should have the right to gamble if that's what they want to do, but we want them to realize what can happen if they do take that chance. There is, you know, the personality of addictive compulsive behavior for some people, and it's those people that the lottery is preying on. I just feel really, really sad for the people that are still out there and the people that I talk to, that they're going through what my brother went through and what we are still going through as a family. I really feel that suicidal is a huge part of it. 9 out of 10 gamblers contemplate suicide. That's a huge number of people that we are going to eliminate from the state that are good people, they're hard workers, and they're an asset to the state when we allow them to be. So I just really hope that you give it your best thought and think with your heart and know that we're doing what's right for the state of Oregon by allowing the people to vote. And if nothing else, we're getting the education out there so that people know that it is a problem. So, and we are open for questions if you have any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. You brought a very difficult story. I appreciate you taking the time out of your life.
The article that you have is the article that was ran shortly after he died. So, just so you know.
We do have it, and we'll keep it in our record.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there other members who are not members of the lobby who are with you that have tested on HDR 70? Check them up.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, my name is Artis Hager. Our son is a compulsive gambler. He's in recovery. Between he and his friends, his significant other, they amassed $70,000 worth of debt in about 2 years. They're both in recovery, but it still is a real hurt to the family. He lost his children for a time over there. They've come back to him at this time, but it was a... They'll never get over the hurt of video poker. It was the video poker that he was addicted to, and Kathy also. And she had 3 boys. She used their college money to gamble. And I acknowledge, too, that this is a disease of choice. However, when it bites, it's there, and it's there for the rest of your life. You fight it every single day. I think that it may bring in a lot of money to the state of Oregon, but it also costs the state of Oregon a lot of money. There's no way to tell what the impact on the social services or law enforcement is with gambling, because not many people are willing to admit, well, I did this because I'm a gambler. But many times when they commit a crime, it's because of gambling. They cost our welfare system because they lose their homes, they lose their jobs, and we have to take care of them. And also in bankruptcy, that costs us each money. Any way you look at it, you don't like to, indirectly, but we don't like to face it, but that is what happened. And over the, I read just recently in a report that was commissioned by the U.S. government that people in the United States gamble more money than they spend on food, and that's sad. I do appreciate very much the fact that you folks are putting this out to the people to vote on, because it's I do think that they are becoming aware that it is dangerous. They've never had the opportunity to vote on that. And I think that if we had seen in the beginning what the lottery was going to do, we never would have had it. I think that it is wrong for the state to raise money in this manner. Thank you.
My name's Clyde Henniger, and my wife pretty much said it all, I think. We have had some pretty trying times over this video poker and the addiction of our son. We've helped him, we stood by him, and we think we're coming out on top as far as he's concerned, but we've dedicated our time to battling this, however long it takes and whatever it takes. So we really feel that the video poker is causing a lot of problems for the state throughout, and we do appreciate the chance to be here today to testify, and appreciate your getting behind this and doing what you can for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, please, witnesses? Thank you for coming today. I do have Mr. Marbet and the other gentleman.
Mr. Simmons, members of the committee.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Terry Teal. I am not a registered lobbyist, but I'm hoping that you will still welcome my testimony today.
Certainly.
That's
the point, Mr. Chair. We wanted to hear from people who were not
lobbyists. Well, I guess I'm very welcome today, then. Thank you, Representative Mannix. I know this seems like a complicated issue, but personally, for me, listening to some of the folks that testified before me, in particular Rhonda, really clarifies the issue for me and reminds me of just how addictive the video lottery games can be, and also how we as Oregonians have suffered. I know working with Senator Lim, I saw estimates as high as 100,000 problem gamblers in the state of Oregon. I believe that would be the third or fourth largest city in the state of Oregon if you put them all together. It's a pretty significant number. What we have before us is a referral to the people. The people voted on lottery, but they did not vote on video poker. Video poker was introduced, as I'm sure you all know, Representative Simpson, members, legislatively and administratively. And for me, the issue is pretty straightforward. I think it's important enough to go to the people and say, do you want this or not? Is HJR good public policy? I'm going to be real frank here and maybe a little daring and say, I don't know. What I do know is I think it's an important enough issue that we should ask the people. We should go to the people and say, do you think this is a good trade-off? Do you think it's a good trade-off to get these dollars to pay for good programs in exchange for this fairly highly addictive form of gambling that has caused 50,000 or 100,000 people in the state of Oregon to sell their cars, to take their life, to do this, to do that. That is my position, and I'm sure Mr. Marbet can take care of any of the more detail-oriented aspects of the bill. So at that, I will end my testimony and ask you all to support this and send it to the people. Thank you very much.
Mr. Marbet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lloyd Marbet. I appear before you today representing myself and Stop Oregon's Gambling Addictions, a political action committee that was originally formed to oppose Ballot Measure 66 in the 1998 general election. We appear before you today testifying in support of HDR 70. You, as legislators, have a wonderful opportunity to provide Oregonians with both a choice and an example. The choice you provide with the passage of HDR 70 would allow Oregon citizens for the first time to vote on whether they want video poker in Oregon. In 1984, Oregon voters approved two ballot measures that authorized and created the Oregon State Lottery. Neither of these ballot measures authorized video poker. In 1992, the legislature expanded the lottery to include video poker. Since its introduction, gambling revenues have quickly grown to become the second largest source of state government revenue next to the income tax. It is hard to find a state program that doesn't have some connection to gambling revenue. I attach for your review statistics that we have gathered on Oregon's gambling addiction, and I'll just go through those briefly. 10% of Oregon state revenue now comes from state-run gambling. State-run gambling revenue is now only second to the income tax. 80% of lottery funds come from video poker. Oregon has the largest state-run video poker operation in the nation, which is a statistic that I find shocking. There are 9,062 video poker machines in Oregon at 1,885 businesses. In 3 out of 4 cases of problem gambling, video poker led to addiction. Video poker is one of the most addictive forms of gambling. 450,000 residents, 20% of the adult population, try the games each week. There are 70,000 problem gamblers in Oregon. About 700 Oregonians are in treatment for gambling addiction at any one time. These are quotes from various studies and reports that have been done. It is hard to accept what is happening to us. It is not too late to change course. I am certain that you will hear testimony today regarding the tragic costs of gambling in Oregon. From the number of stories that are appearing in the media, there is a growing awareness of the price we pay with gambling addiction. There is also a growing concern that no matter how much gambling money we funnel into education or other wonderful programs, we are also sending a message to our children that it is all right to pursue something for nothing, that it is okay to prey on our neighbors as long as others derive benefits, and that the obligation of citizenship doesn't necessarily mean that we as a people have a responsibility to pay our fair share of the cost of government. The real tragedy of state-promoted gambling is all the time growing in the consciousness of generations to come. It is obvious that supporting the passage of HDR 70 will require great courage on your part, even though you are merely offering the people of Oregon an opportunity to decide for themselves whether this is truly the means by which we should fund our government and meet our obligations as citizens. It will be easy to pass the buck, especially since there are already 2 initiatives which have been sponsored to accomplish the same goal as that contained in HDR 70. And I attach for your review a copy of the text of each of these initiatives along with a press release announcing their filing. This, of course, brings me to the second opportunity that you have to provide Oregonians with an example. As you know, I have testified before you on a number of bills in this legislative session and in past legislative sessions regarding various proposals to restrict Oregon's initiative and referendum process. You've heard much testimony depicting the growing number of initiatives which are being circulated, along with the criticism that the initiative process lacks a deliberative process equal to that of the legislature. It is ironic that you have an opportunity to address both of these concerns in the bill before you today. You can show all Oregonians that both legislative processes can be made to work, that it is possible for the citizens of the state to successfully raise controversial issues before you that are, yes, even threatening to government revenue sources, but are also of great enough concern to the continuing health and welfare of our citizens that you are at least willing to provide a legislative forum for us to choose an alternative path. You also have an opportunity to show how you can help provide a deliberative process after you pass HDR 70 to a vote of the people. You can do so by holding sufficient hearings between now and the election in order to create an even greater forum for reviewing the impact of stopping Oregon's gambling addiction. This is truly a win-win solution, which in no way needs further legislative powers beyond those that you already have. Thus, we respectfully ask that you act on this opportunity and pass HJR 70 to the floor of the House with your full support. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you on this momentous occasion and am once again available to answer your questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Thiel or Mr. Maudette? Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize about the room. I don't think that your written testimony didn't cover my question. My question is, if the HDR 70 was to pass, would that also ban line games and video poker machines in Indian casinos? Can you answer that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I have not done an extensive analysis to find out whether HJR 70 would in fact ban line games at Indian casinos or not. But I will say this. I know that this issue is of concern on both sides of the community that is taking a position on gambling. And I, for one, testify before you today with a clear understanding that I have no problem at all if it does apply. And I know that that raises concerns on the other side of the community about whether or not this is doing an injustice, a further injustice to the Indian people who are doing their desperate best to try and make up for the problems that they have, the serious problems that they have suffered in the past. I think, and I share the concern of the Indian community when it comes to that particular issue. I do. But I don't believe that because these injustices have been suffered in the past, that gives some kind of a blank check to create future injustices or present injustices that we now suffer from gambling. And I know that may not be the kind of response that you were seeking, but I just have not had the opportunity to go
for it. I would like to make an opinion for it. Mr. Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding, having been approached by a number of the consumers that are represented in this building, that this would have a negative effect on their opportunity to have line games, video poker in their casino establishment. And that answers your question, Representative Beyer, I believe. And I have a question for Mr. Marbet. I was approached by one of those casino lobbyists in the building and asked if I would consider amending the bill, amending the resolution, somehow exempting the casinos out of the language, and I'm not sure if that's possible or how that would happen. But if that were the case and we were able to move forward with a resolution that ridded video poker through the state lottery that still allowed it in the casinos, would you still support HDR 70?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, I believe any step forward in this direction is a worthy step to take. I would encourage you not to take it out of the bill, but I understand the trade-offs that are probably be faced here in the legislature if you try and go the distance on this one. I think that there is enough of a concern and a problem here that it is definitely incumbent upon you to act. And if the Indian casinos represent a significant issue to you, and the only way this bill can go out is to provide some amendment that takes out the Indian casinos, I encourage you to do it anyway, because I think it will give Oregonians a clear opportunity to vote on whether they intended this to happen. We intended this to happen to ourselves.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Mr. Mayor?
I can't help but observe that this is not a comment on the Indian tribes, it's a comment on our own hypocrisy. The fact that although our own Constitution says, at the very end, right now, the Legislative Assembly has no power to authorize and shall prohibit casinos from operation in the state of Oregon, we theoretically have no casinos. We have simply allowed Indian tribes to provide more and more gambling games. And we just hold back just enough so that we can kid ourselves that they're not casinos. But I have to add the observation that the benefit of that environment, at least, usually alcohol is kept away from, at least from what I've heard and seen, from some of the gambling. There's some separation of alcohol, and some casinos don't have any alcohol at all, which is an irritating, aggravating, exacerbating factor. And the other is that at least you've localized this in a situation where there's a lot of people present, and then and there could be, you would hope, some policing of someone who may be engaged in chronic gambling, and you would hope there'd be some intervention to get them to stop. My question would be whether or not it would be viable from your perspective to talk about allowing the state to go through its own withdrawal syndrome. The state is now addicted to gambling in terms of income, but setting up a, say, a 10-year transition plan where each year 10% less machines are allowed to be used, and you have, get this, a lottery where the allocation of the remaining machines is allowed, so that at the end of 10 years, the machines have been removed, but you've allowed a gradual elimination of what has become an addictive source of income.
We can call it the patch.
But I would like your reaction to that.
Chair, Representative Manning. It's kind of interesting that when you talk about this kind of addiction, you want to tack on 10 years, but when you talk about drug addiction, you want it to end right off. I don't see basically any difference. I really don't. And in fact, you know, if we're so concerned about state revenues, you know, why isn't the state in business selling drugs? I mean, it equates to the same kind of problem, I think, that we have presently placed within society with the current gambling that is going on in this state. I myself cannot support it, but obviously I'm sure there could be a number of excuses that could be given in order to provide time for the state to extricate itself from this. I would point out, though, that another way to address that is to basically provide that as an alternative choice to the public if you want. But I think the public deserves the right to have a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
I would also have a concern, Representative. I like that idea, frankly, but I would also have a concern. We're dealing with a political process here, and we would be talking about five different legislative sessions. I know in Idaho, and this is a little bit off subject, but when they banned dog racing because there was widespread abuse, it's a sunset clause on simulcasting, and a few legislative sessions passed, and it came at the last minute, and they repealed the sunset clause. So I would be concerned, Representative, with that type of a system that three sessions down the road or four sessions down the road, one form of gambling or another would come in and say, this is what we need, we're losing our revenues, we're dying here, we need you to help us, and that would create a problem there. But I like the idea.
It would be in the Constitution, so
right.
It would be told the people would be in the Constitution.
Right.
And then the issue of when what's going to happen next, what will change next, is something we all consider daily.
That's just general concern. But I think
that your point is
that
we should be going cold turkey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Manning, to be fair, the initiatives that are sponsored have a year's phase-in period. So, again, I, of course, had other ideas about that language.
Very well, confusing two things, though, in this discussion. I think the first thing is that when we employ the example of an Indian reservation, an Indian gaming casino,
versus a non-Indian gaming casino. I think we're falling under, we're complicating two sets of laws. I think this is an open question to my colleagues on the bar. But are we not in, including nation within a nation, federal treaty statutes within state statutes? Now we're
on to that.
Well, I'm asking you, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The federal law said that Indian gaming houses had to be given access to any games of chance which are legal and allowed within the state. And so what's happened is with the variety of games of chance that we've kept adding in throughout the state, including those that are allowed to be run by charities in various ways, the negotiation allows more and more games of chance to take place, so that although technically Oregon's Constitution says you can't have a casino, within the state we don't have any casinos. We only have them on reservation property, but they are properly called casinos because the aggregate number of games that we allow throughout the rest of the state, although they're not in one place, are the equivalent of what you'd find in a casino. That was the point I was really making. And if you withdraw the state from a video poker, I don't think you're forced to withdraw all of the casinos from the games that they're providing. There may be an argument about some of the games that they provide. And I suppose that would be a technical question we'd have to address later on.
And I think that's really, I think that's the crux of the discussion for the last portion, if it was this ballot measure we could go through hypothetically. What would be the impact on those games of chance that are not state-run necessarily, but on that type of game within reservation land?
This is Devlin.
Conversely, my understanding of this, Mr. Chairman, prior to actually, I believe it was around the 96 period, was that if the state prohibited a certain form of gambling and did not provide an exception for an Indian casino, then it would be prohibited for them. And that's why I think a lot of parties, when this was, I think it was either prior to the 98 or around the 96 initiative cycle, when Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and a couple others were considering a ban on video poker, or a ban not so much on video poker, but on the expansion to line games, when the Lottery Commission was considering an expansion to line games, that they put, they had made the decision to make an exception to the casino. I think the primary reason they did that had more to do with the fact that the casinos, the Indian tribes themselves, had made substantial investments based upon future revenue, engaging in what was the lawful practice at that time, and it felt some problems with taking away that source of revenue after they made the investment, given that the tribes would have no way to retain the investments that they had made. And I guess that's the reason why I think to do the politics of this, to even have a chance to get a bill through this building, would be that you'd have to at least make some limited exception for the Indian casino.
Mr. Green, you want to respond to that, Mr. Marbet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I don't disagree with the characterization that you're making. I do think, though, that we need to take a careful look at just exactly what kind of impact this bill actually has on the Indian casinos. I don't think it's going to stop the casino operations. Gambling would still be allowed. And frankly, I don't know how that, if that's the case, I think you would be making a case that somehow or another, or at least the information you're supplying makes the case that somehow or another that damages the investment that they made. I'd make the contrary case. I don't think it damages their investment at all. It just takes out an addictive, a very, very addictive form of gambling and leaves what else they've got there.
Is it William?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to comment, and this isn't directed to the two panelists, and I want to thank the families that have actually come down and testified today on what is a very a tragic story. I'll just say from my own experience, Mr. Chairman, I had the opportunity to represent in my law practice a handful of different companies over the past few years who have had an increase in the embezzlement rates within their organizations. And in each one of the cases in which I handled, Mr. Chairman, the embezzlement was specifically related to the embezzler's gambling addiction. And I don't think, and my experience has been, as I talk to other people who practice in the civil law arena and sometimes get involved in these very difficult employee embezzlement sorts of situations, that that is actually on the rise. And I don't think it's a surprise based on the evidence we've heard about the addiction. So there is a cost beyond merely the cost that we've talked about here, but there is a direct business cost associated with the increasing number of Oregonians who are addicted to gambling. And that cost comes in very difficult white-collar crime situations where they embezzle money from their employers in order to continue to play these games, all the while believing that they will eventually hit it big and be able to repay this secret debt which they have created. And in every case I've been involved with, Mr. Chairman, that has not happened. The person ended in bankruptcy. Oftentimes the companies have not prosecuted, although they've always terminated the employment relationship.
Representative Beck.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Does this have to be a referral, or is this something we could do statutorily? Anybody staff know? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, the reason why there are two initiatives that are filed currently in the Secretary of State's office is because one of those is a statutory amendment and the other one is a constitutional amendment. So, in fact, if you wanted to, you could pursue a statutory avenue to accomplish the same thing.
Sure, I guess that's where I've raised this many times, our proclivity toward referring things out to voters, that we ought to, if we really think change is made, we should just do it. We have enacted video poker laws here, and I think we want to, rather than sending it to voters, I think we ought to figure out how to change the statute to get rid of them. Maybe it's a phase out, maybe not. The other concern I have is that the whole fiscal issue, we create fiscal problems that throw a monkey wrench into the whole budget system. We let the voters decide, and then we have to come back to discussion and pick up the debris. Why don't we just really want to get rid of video poker? Let's do it now, and let's figure out whether or how we want to replace the revenue. To see the treasury here, we've gone into, they're gone now, but we've got bonding that is lottery back. It's going to be impacted by this, and I'd rather see it be part of our broader budget discussions or budget cuts, so that we aren't faced with this, what has become sort of a typical situation every session, this one being an exception perhaps, where we come back after a November election with the degree of several initiatives, criminal justice changes, wonderful reforms, whatever you want to call it. But I just think this is a wonderful opportunity for us to show the people of Oregon we are brave, we are courageous, and we have the guts to make these changes that a lot of people in Oregon want. I'm willing to go there and have it be part of the budget context as well.
Briefly, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I was hoping I'd get an opportunity to share with you my new bumper sticker concept, which reads, "Give Oregon dams away, charge us for Trojan, addict us to gambling, what do we get? Corporate welfare for out-of-state corporations, video poker for the poor." This legislature is already in the process of aiding the utilities in removing a significant revenue source that could be used to offset the kinds of monies that might be impacted or will be impacted by the removal of video poker machines. It seems that the corporations have a good time in the legislature. The people, though, unfortunately, are made to suffer.
I would kind of start with your thoughts.
Yeah, Danny, I would agree with you, Representative Beck. I mean, I would vote to get rid of it tomorrow. But the one reason why I think that it's important to let the voters have a say in this is because the voters had the original say. They're the ones that started the lottery in the state. And sure, they didn't have a vote. They didn't have a vote on this exact part of the lottery, but they did start the ball rolling, and it maybe rolled, I believe, beyond where they perhaps intended it to go, and I think it would be important to let the voters have their say in this one. As far as the budget debate, the 2001 legislature would have that debate.
We could carry this on.
Yeah, we could carry this on all night long. And then we do have several other people signed up. I'll leave it to the sense of the committee. We do have several signed up yet to testify. We could finish this as soon as we eat dinner, or we can just sit here until 8 o'clock. Or we could...
Representative Benson, if I can make one very short closing comment. just respond to Representative Beck. It's not entirely clear what the revenue impact of this would be. I know from working with the racing statutes and those issues, that was a $300+ million year industry, which has been reduced significantly since the advent of video poker. So there alone you would have, theoretically, that industry come back. You would have, theoretically, perhaps some of the traditional games come back to some level. So it's a complicated issue, and I obviously would...
Mr. Keel, I think that would all be fleshed out. Make up our decision to head down this road in a major way. All that has to be certainly considered.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could I respectfully suggest that perhaps we could just have a 20-minute break, grab a bite, and roll right back in?
I was going to suggest half an hour. And half an hour, 20 minutes, either way. 20 minutes would be 6 o'clock. We'd come back in here and try to get more work done this evening. If the other members of the committee are agreeable.
I think it's 6:10.
Half an hour. Okay. we will recess the hearing until 6:10. Anthony, introduce your name, yourself for the record, and just to say who you are.
My name is Anthony Haseman, and I want to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to speak. And I think that the gambling is not only addictive to the people that are putting the money in the machines, but the people that have the machines in their businesses, because they get so addicted to having the money that they don't. Like my mom, her boss says, you can't close until everybody's gone. If they're, you can't just say, okay, we're closing, get out. Because we need the money and stuff. And then my uncle, he took his life because of gambling. And I mean, which would you guys rather lose? A couple of your favorite stores, or friends, or family? Just want you to think about that.
Well, thank you, Anthony. It takes a lot of courage to sit up here and speak up, and I appreciate your willingness to do that. Thank you. Any questions for Anthony? Okay, let's go to Star.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in committee, the finest committee in the Capitol, I might add.
For the record.
Representative Bruce Starr, Western Washington County, House District 3. Just like to thank Representative Simmons for holding this hearing on what I believe is a very, very important issue that's in this state right now. We talk about lottery dollars in this building, and the lottery dollars that we spend in this building are not free money. The lottery dollars that are in this money, that are in this building, cost this state, cost our society dearly. The reason I brought this resolution forward is I have a really strong concern about the explosion in this state of state-sponsored gambling. We have a situation where we've had a proliferation of video poker, where we have an ability of our citizens to play these video poker games, video poker machines, without having to jump in their car and drive an hour or an hour and a half or 45 minutes to the nearest Indian casino. Instead, they can hop in their cars and drive a couple of blocks to the corner tavern, to the corner deli, and can plop in their money into these machines, like $5, $10, $20 bills. I'm really concerned about what video poker is doing to our state. As we've heard the testimony tonight, this afternoon and tonight, it is damaging our families. It's tearing families apart. It's taking fathers away from their children, taking mothers away from their children, tearing marriages apart. As you heard testimony tonight, it's costing business money because these folks are addicted to this activity, requires the funding, the funds to play the game, a chance to win it big. Oh, this next time, one more time. I just know next time it's going to be my jackpot. I just need that extra $100 so I can plug it in. I just know it. It's going to happen. It's bound to happen. They need those money. They need those funds from somewhere. And as you heard Representative Williams talk about tonight, the cases of embezzlement, I urge you, in the next few weeks, whenever you look in the newspaper and you see a story of somebody that's been convicted of embezzlement, dig deep in that story. Find out the reason, the cause of that embezzlement, why these people did what they did. And as I have done, and so many times, the root cause, the bottom line reason why those kinds of crimes are being committed is gambling. Saw it in my own city as a city employee in our police department. I believe that this is an important conversation that we're having. We've begun tonight. It's already been begun outside this building, as you heard. And I believe that it's a conversation that regardless of what we do in this building, this state will have. I would urge us to be the ones that bring that discussion forward. You'll have testimony later after I'm done about the fact that the state is handling. You're dealing with these folks that are addicted to this activity. The state's got programs. We're dedicating funds. We're dedicating money. We're going to take care of these gambling addicts. We've got the programs just to prove it. These programs are effective at getting these people out of this addiction. That's what the claims will be. And it's ironic that we take money from one hand, we shuffle it through, and we use it to try to solve this problem that we created.
not only do we create it, but we allow it to proliferate. We allow it to expand. I don't believe that video poker in this state is worth the life of one more Oregonian. It's not worth it. The hundreds of millions of dollars that this state collects from video poker, it's not worth the collateral damage that it's caused in this state to families, to marriages, to kids that lose their moms and dads and uncles and aunts and grandmothers and grandfathers. This is a serious, serious issue. And I think it's time that we as a legislative body recognize that, bite the bullet, make the tough choice. That's really not that tough if you think about it, because we're not doing the damage. I mean, we're not the ones that are making the final decision. We're allowing the voters to decide. Let the voters decide if they want to have this kind of activity continue in this state. I know that the money that this program brings to this state is important to so many state budgets. And not only are the people that play this game addicted to doing it, but the state of Oregon is addicted to the money. We have ballot measure that comes forward that says, hey, let's protect streams, salmon, let's protect our state parks. You know, the legislature failed to do its responsibility, but the voters can do it. And we got this free pot of money over here. Free money, it doesn't cost anything. And we can save fish, and we can save salmon, and we can save our park system. We can save public education. And the legislature itself did that. It passed a referendum to the voters to save 15% of the lottery goes to education. This money is not free money. It's costly. Extremely costly. We talk about the loss of state revenue to the state and what it means to the budget. That money that doesn't get played in video poker may well get played in other gambling that's illegal in the state. Very well may happen. But I believe that it wouldn't happen to the degree that it's happening now. And those dollars, instead of taking money away from dollars that should be spent on food and things for the kids and the mortgage and paying the credit cards, the money should go to those areas. That money would stay in the state. That money would not completely be gone to the state coffers. Plus, we would save the other costs that are brought forward here. As you can tell, I'm a little bit passionate about this issue. I understand that the high hurdles, the tough choices that are before us here, I have to make the same choices. But I think it's important that we continue this discussion. I look forward to talking with each of you, and hopefully we can find a way to move this resolution forward that would accomplish the goals that I think are ones that we should accomplish, and do it in such a manner that would minimize the immediate impact that it might have in the state and its budget. You know, it's ironic that we would take that route, but I think that's probably, if this is going to move forward, the only way that's feasible. As Woodmar Bett said, we don't expect that of the drug addict. You know, we want to begin cold turkey, but state government, you know, we'll protect ourselves and our budgets and whatnot. We've had a long hearing already, and I appreciate your indulgence as I've talked about this issue. I would answer any questions if you might have them, and I know we have some other folks that want to testify as well.
Thank you, Representative Starr. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Starr, I'm not a lottery fanatic. What is paramutual? I don't understand the difference between these the different definitions here. You have a 67 or a paramutual game in.
mean, there is a definition there, but what is the game? I don't know for sure. Honestly.
Perhaps when the lottery folks come up, we can ask them that question.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Manning.
Representative Williams and I have been having a conversation over here about this topic, and Representative Beck a little earlier participated in such a conversation, and we've raised the thought, Representative Williams is developing the thought, that we need a little reality check for the legislature. The fact that, yes, there is an initiative out there, and yes, that initiative could get on the ballot, and yes, that initiative could cut off your poker. At the same time, the state has become addicted to this revenue source, but the legislature could establish a withdrawal program. Over 10 years, Representative Williams has been outlining it. I'm not saying I'm stealing his thunder, but he's been putting together an idea. I'll let him speak.
I didn't share this one with Raleigh either. I didn't share the last one with Raleigh either.
This is where this hearings process can be useful, because it may be that there would be something of a coalition willing to say, we need to work with our restaurants and bars and protect them over time and give them some opportunity to adjust. This is a state would have to adjust. It put us on a withdrawal program with a finite term and say that we've got to get off this. And
well, Mr. Chair, I think... Representative Manning. We sit up on judiciary together, and he's a chairman down there. So this isn't going to move tonight. We are going to hear it, and as you come across ideas, I hope you'll put them to paper. And any further questions, for Representative Scott?
Just to answer the Representative Barr's question, in page 3. Line 5 of the bill, it describes what permeable means.
I recognize that, but I don't know what that definition means.
Well, we can ask a lot of folks when they get here.
Is that a ghost race? Is that a video poker machine? I don't know.
It's not a video lottery game, because that one is identified in the next section down. So, and that's the one that I'm targeting.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carr. And the folks from the... Chris Lyons from the lottery. Do you have some people with you there?
Not to be hypocritical, can I check with you about my megabuck?
Yes, you can. No, I just didn't want to look at
me. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Lyons. I'm the director of the Oregon Lottery, and with me this evening is David Hooper, our public affairs manager. As with the proposed ballot initiative that would prohibit the Oregon Lottery from conducting video lottery games, our agency takes no position on HJR 70. The legislature passed those statutes nearly 8 years ago for two reasons. One, the first one was to generate replacement revenue for property tax limitations that were imposed by ballot measure 5. And the second reason was to bring regulation to about 10,000 video poker and slot machines that were being illegally operated in the state at the time. The Oregon Lottery has accomplished both of the assignments from the legislature. Nonetheless, as you've heard today, the argument remains that the citizens have really never actually voted on this question of video poker. A small sort of side comment here is when the constitutional amendment was adopted, it did say that the Oregon Lottery could offer any game using any game technology. But the fact remains that lottery games were really what was in the minds of the voters at the time. And this question, as you heard today, continues to come forward that the citizens of Oregon really have never voted on this issue. But before I answer your specific questions about video poker, I'd like to focus my comments on a couple sections of the bill that will impact games above and beyond video lottery. HDR 70 seems to be intended to prohibit video lottery games, but it would also impact lottery games such as Keno, which is displayed on a video screen and monitored by a central system. Likewise, the parimutuel requirement in Section 7 would impact the lottery's other online games as well. In addition to Keno, these games would include Sports Action, Megabucks, Powerball, and Cash Quest. Each of these games include prizes that have preset amounts, and they would require significant reworking to replace the guaranteed prize levels that these games currently offer players. And we can come back and maybe have a dialogue about parimutuel. Under House Joint Resolution 7B's parimutuel requirement, we would not be able to offer Powerball. Keno and Cash Quest would be unworkable under a parimutuel prize structure. Furthermore, Sports Action sales would be reduced if all prizes had to be parimutuel. I bring these issues up really just to begin to gain clarification about the bill's intent. Once that's understood, some new language may need to be developed and revenue impacts may need to be adjusted. As written, however, HJR 70 will have revenue impacts above and beyond the $450 million per biennium that would be lost to the state if video lottery games were prohibited. As written, the state could lose an additional $70 million per biennium without these traditional lottery games. Again, Mr. Chairman, the Lottery Commission isn't opposed to asking this question of whether or not the Oregon Lottery should offer video lottery games. I hope my comments will help clarify the question being proposed to voters, and I would encourage you to take care in crafting the language that is both technically correct and unambiguous. David and I really are here to answer any questions that you might have about the language of the bill or video games, so we'll welcome any questions.
Mr. Byer, do you want to address the parimutuel question?
Yeah, I'm still confused. What exactly is meant by parimutuel game?
Oh, David.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, parimutuel is a system where the prizes are divided equally among all winners. For example, Megabucks game, the jackpot game, has a parimutuel jackpot. If the jackpot's $2 million, there are two winners of the jackpot, they would each receive $1 million. The sales are proportioned out for 5 or 6. That's divided equally among the number of winners on down to the 4 or 6 income. So that's really what parimutuel means. Prizes are awarded equally amongst all winners. Agent Starr.
I'll pass at this point. You have any questions?
This is Devin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had a kind of a really couple of basic questions about video poker because I don't play video poker in reality. I mean, play poker. But I watched a few people playing the machine, and I guess it would depend upon the speed with which someone plays. But I know that machines accept different denominations. In theory, how much money could somebody lose in an hour at a video poker machine?
It's very tough to answer theoretically what somebody could lose. The odds of winning a hand in video poker are about 1 in 2. I will say that each dollar put in the machine generates about $5 worth of play. In other words, credits won, credits wagered.
It's
a luck factor, and ball random.
Have we ever done any studies about what usage is like? What the I can remember back in the days when we used to do studies about the customers' purchases and habits in grocery stores. So imagine somebody's done studies on how people play, how much time the average person plays.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, if that's your question, I don't remember the numbers exactly, but we have. When we test these pieces of equipment and certify them, we do run them, and there's a test that we can do, and on I think the number is about 10% of the actually of the electronic capacity is being used. In other words, if somebody just, you know, held the thing down, held the button down, and really didn't care what was going on in terms of feeding money, but you could put the thing on sort of auto, and you could do that when we're running huge tests. So the machine has a capacity to play quickly, but the human being, and you know, within our own environment, the capacity to generate revenue is really it's about 10%.
Okay.
If I'm getting,
you don't have any studies that you could cite, or is it possible for somebody to lose a couple hundred dollars an hour playing the machine?
It's possible to lose a couple hundred dollars. It's possible to win a couple of $100. The payout, in terms of churn, what's going on with the machine, all of the play that's occurring, the payout is about 90%. In other words, there's credits and winning. There's 90% winning and 10% losing in terms of what's actually going on the video screen. So yes, it is possible to lose a couple of hundred dollars in an hour. It's possible to win that.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I answer the question is I'm not a player. I have went a few times in the Portland metropolitan area, and I think in other places now. We have some establishments that are, to some extent, devoted to video poker. I mean, I won't name the establishments, but that's been a question. And I have went in, the food is cheap, and just watched people play. And it's been hard for me to determine, you know, how much they were losing. I remember one elderly couple where the husband was playing and the wife was kept handing him 20s about every 5 or 10 minutes. So I don't have any idea, you know, of just what the magnitude of what the losses could be. But it's surprising to me that the lottery hasn't done any studies on that, because in previous life I've seen studies where we studied customers' habits extensively, and obviously for the lottery, players of video poker are customers. So.
Yes, and as I said, we really have not done those kinds of studies.
Presumably.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lyons, I assume that the lottery has done some studies to determine what the average pay for a particular machine is on an hourly basis, have they not? I mean, go ahead and answer that honestly.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, we do know what those machines on average produce on a daily basis, by machine type, on average throughout the state. We could go into our computer records and look, because of the security features associated with the systems, we could tell you the play that is being generated, the states take and the retailers take down to the machine level in any retail business in the state.
So
we can roll those numbers.
Monica, to you, I've got several questions.
Yes, sure.
So in other words, you could probably then develop at least on a machine basis and on an average on a per hour what the take was, and if we use your people are winning 90% of the time analysis, we ought to be able to figure out what the turn to the machine is. Am I right?
Right, and I want to make sure that I was clear in terms of answering the question. I didn't say we couldn't work towards these answers. I think the question was, have we ever really done that kind of study? And in my knowledge, we haven't. But we have the capacity to theoretically generate this kind of information, sir.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Vice Chair, might I continue? Oh, no, you're there. I thought you stood up. I'm sorry. Okay, you're there. Good. I saw somebody stand up over there.
Okay. Can you tell me how many games currently does the lottery have in play?
On video poker, sure?
No, I mean total lottery games. Everything from scratch tickets to what have you got going now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, we really have 8 categories of games. Scratches are one of them. Break open games, which are another form of instant ticket. You break open the ticket instead of scratching it off. We have the Mega Bucks, Powerball, Keno, Sports Action, and a game called Cash Quest, which are known as online games. back in the old days when that technology was put in place, they were run through the telephone lines to a central system. That's what online meant at the time. And then we have video poker. So there are really 8 different types of games. And then within Scratcher, of course, you know, we may have a dozen different Scratcher games out at any point in time.
Mr. Chairman, when I hear lottery advertising, I actually hear more about Scratch-It games, quite frankly, than I think I hear about anything else. What does it typically cost to run an ad campaign for the introduction of a new Scratch-It game?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, I kind of broke that down to for each game, but you're quite right. Scratch-Its are really the only game that we do advertise on TV, primarily. We do spend about $5 million a year in advertising. We do not advertise video, nor do we allow our retailers to advertise video. So, but we have other advertising in there as well, besides the Scratch-Its. The problem gambling advertising we do is the where the money goes advertising.
It's kind of the institutional advertising that shows the lottery doing, the lottery money being used for good things. That's included in the $5 million.
Yes, sir. Let me give you a
I'm sorry. I will.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, yep. On our scratch tickets, we would spend next year probably about $2 million on media, really, for that game. We would advertise, I think the plan is to advertise 6 or 7 different scratch tickets. They'd divide that 6 or 7 into that $2 million, and you could get a sort of an average idea about what we would spend in terms of the media associated with that scratch ticket. That would be the TV production, the TV media. If we in a particular time wanted to, you know, also do radio for a particular ticket, it really depends on the ticket, but I think you sort of get a sense of what we would be sort of spending on average per scratch ticket.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
what, give me an idea based on the total amount of lottery money generated for the state of Oregon. What percentage is video poker as compared to these other 7 categories of games that you've identified for us?
It is, in terms of net revenue, 79-80% of net revenue.
Further questions? Representative Devlin?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, just 2 questions. First, it's actually not a question, but a clarification. I wasn't actually looking for the average use. I was looking for, you know, if the person was addicted, how much could they actually lose on an hourly basis? And the second question I had is when you said the people, this is the actual question, when you said people, I guess, did you say that 9 out of 10 times they're actually winning? Or?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. What I was trying to communicate to you is that when you stick $10 into the machine and you're playing, you're winning and you're losing along the way. And in terms of how we set the prizes, the payout percentage, and that's how we calculate this in the gambling industry, the payout percentage associated with our video poker games is on average about 90%. So about 90% of the play goes back to the player, where for some of our other games, like a scratch game, about 65% of the play in terms of the churn goes back to the player.
Two follow-ups. Now, you're including winnings when you get credits in addition to when you actually cash out, right?
Yes, sir. And I'm doing that not to try to deceive you in any way, but that is in fact how the sales are calculated through the system and are calculated with the casino industry, and that is how it's calculated. So it's every time you win some credit, as you are moving forward, you are generating what's classified as sales, and then if you lose some, that's subtracted from sales, and so it's a theoretical payout percentage of 90%.
Final.
Yes, it's the devil.
If, and I have your letter here, this would result in a loss of $400+ million. Just the loss of video equipment.
Yes, sir.
How much money is going through the machine? Do we know that?
If you want the churn number in terms of play, I really don't want to confuse you, but the churn number is upward to $5 billion is churned through. What comes out net after prizes is, you've got that number?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is David Hooper, Public Affairs Manager. This really does happen in two categories, cash into the machine and dollars played. Cash into the machine was $852 million in FY98. Prizes paid out $455 million. The difference gives you the net. If you look at that, 862 generated $4.2 billion in play, that's the churn, and $3.8 billion in prizes. That's when you get the 90% payout. So really actual cash in the machine, 862 with prizes paid of 455, the net on all that is $400 million.
Chairman, could we just skip those numbers?
Sure. We'll be glad to submit that.
Let me get back that figured out. Every dollar that's played, a person gets 90 cents back.
I didn't say that. I said when you put a dollar in, you play on that dollar, and you win and you lose, and that is considered churn, and so that is calculated by the gambling industry as sales. But if you put a dollar in the machine, what eventually would come out in terms of money out of the machine to the state would be about half of that. If I put a dollar into that machine, I would play that dollar and I would build it up.
That's where the 800 and some million generates 400 and some million and
billion. The 800 million in money that goes in generates billion of play.
But the 800 and some million going in and coming out to the players is some 400 and some goes to the state and some of it goes to the lottery.
Not speaking to Mr. Starr's concern about the ethics and morality. That is up to you to decide. I just want to share with you financially where you are with the lottery and some of the obligations that the legislature has taken on. Video poker represents the primary source of repaying lottery bonds, which is one of our concerns in the Treasury, is the repayment of those bonds. HDR 70 would, for all practical purposes, preclude the issuance of lottery debt in the future. You could not issue lottery bonds in the future. It should be clear. Currently, there are about $250 million of those outstanding in lottery debt. Trying to think, last session, and Representative Maddox and I were talking about this during the break, I think it was Senate Bill 346. That issued about $150 million in proceeds, a lottery bond for education. That would be paid out over 15 years. That's the current obligation. That's an example of the kinds of obligations that you have. I recall the vote on that, it was overwhelming. I think there were 44 ayes, 6 noes, and it was a busy time, and there were about 10 people that weren't there. I think on this committee, Representative Beyer and Beck were near votes. When we issue bonds, there are contractual obligations within those bonds. And plug my microphone. There are contractual obligations within the bonds. There are covenants within the bonds. Let me address just what a couple of those are. The contractual obligations that you have are to repay the bonds, and you have a moral obligation to do so. And a moral obligation is a term of art. That means that if the revenue stream is affected, and there are certain criteria for that, that there is an obligation on the part of the legislature to consider payment of those bonds. One of the covenants in the early bond issuance, I think it's for the light rail, and I do really need to check and see if it's on the last issue, the $150 million in issue, is that if people can stop playing the lottery and the recourse to the holders of the bond is limited, that's the risk that they take. But the legislature is encumbered on removing that resource, the repayment resource. And in fact, I think under some of the covenants, I believe it's for the light rail bond, and we really need to talk to the bond lawyers about this if you move this forward, would obligate the legislature to run the lottery until the bonds are paid off. And I really, if this gets legs, suggest that those bond professionals who put together those covenants be addressed. It's beyond our office. I mean, this is getting technical, and you do have those obligations. Removing the revenue stream could also be taken care of by the legislature. You could pay off and would create an obligation on the general fund, not the same as a general obligation bond, but it would create an obligation on the general fund for that $250 million. You could pay that off, and that would get you out of the business. There would be penalties for doing so. It's the cost of doing business. The other opportunity that you'd have would be to default on the bonds. That would be catastrophic for the bond rating. California defaulted on our bonds, and there were some other issues. They dropped from the AAA rating to jump bond, literally, to jump bond level, to D level. And I don't think that's an option that can be accepted by the legislature. And I would hope that you would never consider that. So I think your options are, if you are going to buy out of the business, to understand that there would be no future revenues from lottery, that you would not bond from lottery in the future, that you have some extended obligations in excess of $250 million that would have to be paid off in some manner, either by continuing the play of the lottery until those obligations are taken out. And
how much is that? $250
million? $200 million in face value. There would be prepayment penalties for that. And I probably could help you gen up those numbers if you could like.
Well, Mr. Wisbrock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wisbrock, we would have to pay off $250 million.
In current value, correct.
And then there would be an additional penalty for early payment?
There's a penalty. That's the current value. And there's some discussion for the bondholders in there. There would be a penalty. And I don't know what that would be off the top of my head.
But obviously,
you can prepay. There are certain... when we issue bonds, we try to create avenue for prepayment should somebody want to do so. When you do that, you have to pay the bondholders. There's a limit how early you can do that. Some of the streams of revenue can be paid off after 5 years or 7 years. And I'm not comfortable with saying what it would be for the $150 million. We sold $162 million to get that value of $150 million. And in most of the covenants, it would protect the bondholders would be protected for a period of time. It could be for 3 to 5 years. I just don't know off the top of my head. And then if you get out, then there would be a penalty that you'd have to pay. And again, I don't know what that penalty would be. It's fairly complex, and you do need your attorney general and bond counsel advising on what those penalties would be.
But those penalties are decipherable.
Yep, they are decipherable.
Okay, the next, another question, sir. Just to follow up on that, obviously, if we're paying these bonds off early, we're saving a significant amount of interest, I would think, in that case.
Mr. Chair, I believe, I don't know what the penalties would be, but it seems reasonable that you're going to save some money on the interest.
Mr. Devlin?
Mr. Chairman. Would the non-video game lottery proceeds, which is probably in the neighborhood of less than $100 million, probably significantly less than that when you get to the net, be adequate to pay off those loans that was their use?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I don't believe so, but I will check. Those are some complex numbers, and I really, you know, don't know if we all know that information, but I think we can determine that. My gut feeling is no, that with all the things that are taken out of lottery, that there probably would not be the income stream. We're compelled, there's a coverage level that we're compelled to maintain at the 4-to-1 ratio of coverage. I think that I can know how the attorneys, in reference to Representative Manick, put these together, and they cover themselves in a number of different ways. Once that 4-to-1 ratio is diminished, I believe that it could be a call on the bonds. It could create a call on the, you know, on the bonds. So you were getting beyond my skill level with how the covenants are drafted. I know the finances of it, but I don't know how the covenants are drafted. And that's like Representative Williams.
Further questions from Mr. Leisbrock?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Williams. Let's try to keep this moving along.
Okay. Rowley, I just wondered, you heard some discussion about the phase down idea, about some sort of a, you know, slow burn as we went from where we're at with video poker down to nothing over a time period. Based on your understanding of the covenants, do you think that that kind of an approach would violate any of the current laws? I think it probably would because of the 4-to-1 ratio if you moved into that area fairly quickly. The light rail bonds have been out long enough that you probably could kick the payments up on those and repay those and maybe get out of that penalty situation just because of the cash flows coming in from the other resources. But my fear is because of the 4-to-1 ratio that's built into the covenant, that you probably would trigger that fairly quickly. There's a 15-year life of those bonds.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I've been saying that. And that's off the top of my head.
Do you think you could get for us some rough figures about how we could withdraw from this in accord with the current bonding requirements? That is, what sort of a schedule could be accomplished over 10 years? Maybe it couldn't be 10% a year to drop. Maybe it'd have to be 10% and then you hold and you can drop, say, in 5 years, another 30% or whatever. But some idea of where we could drop down without violating the deals that we've made in terms of the bonds?
Sure.
These are asked and done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mass, it would probably incur some significant cost, and the cost would be in this area that we would, if it's not something that we have staff on hand, nor is it something that I think our Attorney General would easily be able to do. I think it's going to take, quite frankly, the outside bond counsel. I wouldn't want to have you bet anything in terms of your action on something that we would gen up internally, because I would want the bond counsel to take a very careful look at that. You should know what all your exposure is, and there should be no mistake. It's very complex. So that means going out and hiring a $300 an hour, you know, firm to opine on it. And I think it would take that kind of before we would be willing to start out a boy behind it. So it takes some cash.
These technical questions, I'm sure, could be answered, and the appropriate experts could be brought in. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
We have Bruce from the Cocoa Tribe.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm an attorney with Horang Law and Gary Rednick, and I'm here representing the Coquille Indian Tribe. The Coquille Indian Tribe owns the Mill Casino and Resort in Coos Bay. On behalf of the tribe, I would like to register our opposition to HJR 70
because its applicability to tribal gaming centers like the Mill Casino and Resort is uncertain. Last week, the Attorney General certified a ballot title in Initiative 48, which is a constitutional amendment similar to HJR 70. The Attorney General wrote to the Elections Division with the certification of that ballot title, and I quote, "Determining the precise effect that this would have on the ability of Indian tribes to offer games in their own gaming facilities would necessarily involve extensive legal analysis of the interaction of the proposed initiative measure with the complex interaction already existing between the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and the range of state law provisions relating to gambling activities," unquote. Basically what the Attorney General said to the Secretary of State, he didn't know what the measure would do, and as a result of that, could not produce a ballot title that explained to voters what the effect of the measure would be. It is our concern that HJR 70 has the same technical problems, and we would urge the committee not to pass the resolution because of the uncertainties about what the effects would be on tribal gaming operations.
Good doing that. But you could draft for us an amendment which would include the impact of HJR 70 on casinos on Indian reservations and tribal gaming.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I presume you could draft that. I'm not in the position to draft that.
Well, I know we could, but it seems to me that what I'm suggesting to you is perhaps you could suggest to us some language which would protect the gaming casino.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, our concern is that this is a very complicated area of state and federal law, and we think that passing a resolution, putting a resolution like this to amend the Constitution in front of the people is not desirable public policy, and we would oppose the resolution for that reason.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
I agree with you that silence on the subject creates complications, and therefore the Attorney General looking at an initiative that's silent on the subject would have trouble analyzing the interaction. But not being an expert, but having read enough about the federal laws and looking at the state system, it seems to me that we could put an amendment into a constitutional referral that says that the current status of Indian gaming casinos in Oregon shall be protected. In fact, I think that one sentence will probably do the trick. So my question to you is, if we put something in like that that truly had that legal effect, would that then change your position to neutrality? In fact, I would think it would help business.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I'm here on behalf of the tribe in response to HJR 70. We oppose that resolution.
Usually people who come in, if I may, Mr. Chairman, and oppose, are then asked what might be done to change their opposition. I guess your answer is nothing to change your opposition.
We are very concerned with the state changing the rules under which tribal gaming operations are currently operated.
Bishop, that's a valid concern. To be concerned is certainly honest, but just to simply say we would oppose under all circumstances is really unacceptable.
Mr. Chairman, I did not say we would oppose under all circumstances. I said that the matter before us is HJR 70, and we do oppose HJR 70.
That's currently worded.
If that is the measure that you're considering.
We do amend things.
If
there are questions from the committee?
If you amend things, we'll be glad to give our response to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. McCallum.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike McCallum. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Restaurant Association. We're here today in opposition to HJR 70. We are a trade association that represents about 3,300 restaurants, bars, and taverns around this state. About 700 of those have video lottery within their establishment. A little background on the issue that you heard pieces of, but I think it's very important. In 1991, when we supported legislation that enacted video lottery. It did so for a couple pretty important reasons. At that time, as Director Lyons stated, there was about somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 video games in Oregon. And our local DAs and our Attorney General and our sheriffs and our state cops couldn't figure out a way to handle them. Bottom line. And they've been here for a long time. This isn't new. The problems that you've heard about today have been here in the past, and frankly, they're going to be here in the future. What we did when we passed legislation in 1991 is we took a system that was bleeding my tavern owners on a lot of cases because the guys that owned the machines would put us over a barrel, okay, and hammer us and get more take than, frankly, they should have for owning and placing the machines. They didn't pay taxes on any of the income. There was no money for any public good that came out of those terminals. And there was about as many of them as there are today. We sought to fix that problem. And we did it in a way that I believe has been responsible, has been, frankly, above suspicion in terms of the integrity of the operation of the games, and has provided a tremendous amount of public benefit. Without getting into the money that you all spent, I want to talk a bit about the positives that have occurred in the community. The dollars that have gone into those machines forever in Oregon, not just the last 7 years, are now taxed. The dollars that have gone into those machines for years now go into payrolls in our local community. They provide benefits for employees. They provide avenues for income in sectors of our hospitality industry that previously had to resort to other tactics. And those tactics were often, frankly, over-service in terms of alcohol. And there was more new dancing places per capita then, too, as places looked at avenues of last resort to stay alive. There's been significant positive effects come from the adoption and the legalization of this form of gambling. Again, a form of gambling that's not new. I believe the negatives that you've heard about today are entirely overstated. And I want to tell you a couple of figures to perhaps put this in perspective. Representative Devlin asked about how much money is lost on a terminal each hour. I'm here to tell you that that dollar figure is $6.50. That's what Oregonians lose every hour on a terminal in Oregon. $6.50. I want to talk about the average amount of money that a player plays in Oregon today. An average player plays video lottery 2.6 times in a month, and he spends $4.70. Folks, that's not $15. That's not causing suicides. That's not putting people into bankruptcy. A heavy player, as described by the lottery, plays $35 per month. That's not putting people into despair. What Oregonians are doing is adopting gambling in that fashion as a sense of entertainment, very comparable to a music hall or a theater or a ball game. They are abusing it. They're not overspending. They're not ruining themselves. Those are the facts. Those are the numbers. Don't get caught up in the rhetoric of the emotion around this. I'll tell you that for years, we have products that we sell as a state and we make available that cause devastation. I don't have to tell you, the biggest one's alcohol. You sell it yourself. You won't even privatize it to somebody. You take it, and you tax it, and you sell it. And you use the treatment dollars from the tax
to treat the alcoholic. So is that new? No. There's nothing new here, folks. We've been doing it for years. We do the same thing with tobacco. The exact same thing. So to make any intimation that what we're doing when we fund treatment programs for addiction with lottery dollars, to say that that's inappropriate is simply being two-faced. Because you've been doing it for years, there's nothing new about any of that. Now, I'll tell you, when it comes to addiction treatment, we have a system here that is working. We've got a system that's delivered through the community mental health that you're going to fund, I think, this year at a level that's beyond, frankly, what the treatment providers even ask for. And it's to ensure that the public good that is coming out of this takes care of the addicted personalities that are negatively affected by it. Are there negative effects? Absolutely. Are there individuals who are negatively impacted and are their families devastated? Yeah, there are. Is it more than with alcohol? No. Is stopping video lottery going to take care of those negative effects? No. The reality is they're going to gamble just like they've been gambling forever. They're going to do it at our dog tracks. They're going to do it at our horse tracks. They're going to do it in our card rooms. They're going to do it at the state fairs. They're going to do it at Happy Canyon in Pendleton. They've been doing it forever here, and they're not going to stop. And the people that have those addictive personalities, we have to create a safety net for, and we are. We're doing it responsibly. I would say that as you talk about exempting tribes from these bans, I thought this was a moral argument. So it's okay to gamble over here, but it's not over here. The public dollars that you spend willingly each year supporting very meaningful programs come from the lottery. They don't come from the tribal casinos. The very devastation you've heard about today and purportedly are going to act against is going to be available to them 40 miles down the road. And frankly, it's going to be available to them around the corner, just like it always was prior to the adoption of video lottery. That's not changing, folks. You've heard it. You can't legislate morality. Oregonians have decided this is an acceptable form of entertainment for them. The vast, vast majority are doing so responsibly. Again, an average player, 2.6, this isn't per citizen, this is the players, 2.6 times per month, and they spend $4.70 each time they play. And a heavy player spends $35. That's reality. That's what's going on out there. There's no way you can write an HJR that only takes care of video lottery for the state. It takes care of the tribes too. And I'll tell you, I spent hours and hours with the lawyers on the Indian Gaming Regulation Act and its melding into the state laws here. And it's really pretty simple. Any game that's outlawed in the state, the tribes can't play. Period. Now, can they have a casino? Yeah, they can have a casino. They can play Pot-a-Gal, and they can play Blackjack. Maybe they can even play Roulette. All the games we allow at Happy Canyon. They can play all those. They make 85% of their money, folks, from the machines. They can't exist without those. And you can't write an ordinance that divides one or the other. It won't happen. So I would just leave it with, put this thing in its proper perspective. Look at the positives as well as the negatives. Look at the way we have, frankly, cleaned up gambling in Oregon. Look at the programs you're funding, weigh their value, and look at your options for replacing that. You may say, well, we phase it in over 10 years, it's no big deal. That could very well be correct. I'm not here to say you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying, you shouldn't do it just because you're addicted to the money. If you want to break your addiction, stop today. You don't need HJR 70. You budget that money every 2 years. If you don't want to spend it, don't. Put it in a trust fund. Put it somewhere where you can't get at it. Don't cop out to needing a ballot measure to tell you not to spend the revenue. Happy to answer any questions.
President Bannix.
First of all, I congratulate you on an excellent piece of advocacy. I think we need to emphasize that some of us are not into this as a moral issue. We're into it to some extent, perhaps, as a moral issue because of the... in fact, I'm not sure I'm into it. I'm just hearing some interesting stuff. The question is how far the state goes, how involved the state gets. And one question I would ask you is, should we put some limit on this and say that we're going to, if we're going to continue this process, should we say this far and no further?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, in a very real sense, that has already happened. The governor, in conversations with the Lottery Commission, established a level of 9,500 terminals as what he's willing to allow them to put out. We've got about 8,900, somewhere around there now. So there's 600 more terminals that could be placed. That's approximately another 100 bars, taverns, and restaurants. Frankly, the marketplace takes care of that as well. And we aren't even at the level the people have described at the top, and we're not getting there, frankly, very quick. So in terms of putting a limit on it, I'll tell you, the market's doing that. But if you, and the governor's done that. But if you want to do something in addition to that, it doesn't matter to me.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. McCallum?
I have any more questions. Appreciate your testimony, and I agree that we do have to take care of our addiction before we can try to help someone else with their addiction, and that money does mean a lot to certainly our budget process here. I take exception with one thing, and as you said, everything else I think is quite accurate, but we do and can and do legislate morality, and we started that clear back in the 1770s. That's the basis of our Constitution, right and wrong. And we established that and have ever since. It's just whose morality are we going to legislate this session or next? And so I think you gave very good testimony, and I appreciate that. And I'm not sure what we would do without that income at this point in time. It'd be rather difficult. And what we could do about gambling, I think there's always those in this state that would like to do something. I was never raised with the appreciation for it by any means. But I agree. Cut it off. If we morally say it's wrong, then everybody gets cut. Thank you, Mike.
Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like all issues in this building, this is not a new issue. I mean, the bills in the last session, when they end up being more than one bill in this session, so you'll probably hear us here in another hearing. Probably be bills in the next session. If an initiative gets on the ballot, whether statutory or constitutional, would you make any different arguments to the public than you made to this committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, no. I wouldn't. I believe that there's been significant positives come out of the public-private partnership that's been created through the lottery. I think they tell a compelling story. I would absolutely make the argument that you can't get rid of one without getting rid of it all in relation to video gaming throughout the state. No, I don't believe I'd make any different arguments with the public.
Thank you, Mr. McCallum.
Thank you.
Thank you.
pardon me?
Guns blazing.
I close the public hearing on HJR 70 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3448. Yes, Mr. Moore, give us an update on a summary of House Bill 3448, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, HB 3448. Required an estimated amount of state tax revenue losses due to purchase of items through mail order or electronic transactions. We live in a society in which existing legal frameworks are constantly challenged by technological advances. This creates a need to constantly update and adapt the way in which we organize ourselves in order to maintain the state's overall control of its domestic affairs and national interests. The advent of technology which enables the transmittal of voice, data, image, and video information has been called an informational superhighway. This new technology constitutes a brand new route for exchange of goods and services that has yet to be fully examined. Whereas much has been written on how the information superhighway affects legal issues, such as defamation and patent infringement, substantial questions have yet to be answered in regards to how this new trade route will be treated by various laws of taxation. In fact, the United States Treasury Department has identified the tax ramifications of such highway technology issues as transactions of the Internet as a top priority international issue for 1996. According to Carol Doreen, Deputy International Tax Consultant in the Department of Office of Tax Policy, the possibilities of the Internet are just beginning to be explored, as are the tax implications of doing business over the Internet. Commerce on the Internet, although in its infancy, can take many forms. Home shopping, where consumers browse cyber malls and buy goods through credit cards and electronic cash, will compromise an estimate $7.2 billion U.S. dollars in the marketplace by the year 2000. Electronic cash will form the bedrock of internet transactions and will enable, for example, a consumer to download the latest word processing program or video game right from his or her computer and pay for it with e-cash. In the context of tax avoidance and evasion, the government hopes to be able to intercept the transmission of Americans and thereby assess their tax liability. This would be an effort regulatory mechanism only to the extent that it would catch individuals attempting to avoid or evade taxes. It would not, however, be able to shut down the transmission emanating from tax haven companies. Understood as such, enforcement of domestic tax laws would be accomplished to a degree compared to the number of speeders on the highway. Enforcement would have a mostly deterring effect and would target individuals engaged in large-scale avoidance and evasion schemes that would probably leave the average consumer untouched.
Representative Loken. Thank you for your patience this evening, Representative Loken.
Thank you for hearing HB 3448, and I really appreciate the introduction of the bill. That's very well done and very thorough and complete. I can tell you I don't think that I'll be able to surpass the emotion in the former person at the mic here, but I really appreciate hearing that testimony too. This bill was introduced at the request of a good friend, has developed into a good friend. She opened a news and cigar shop, tobacco shop in Milwaukee, and I learned to know her there. I didn't go in for cigars, but I did go in and pick up the best news articles and magazines that she just couldn't find anywhere. It was a Class A store, and she was a good addition to our city, which was really not thriving very well. And business had been leaving it, and she came in and opened that shop, and it was really a nice addition to the city. However, she had to leave and move elsewhere because of various things that I'm going impact that I'm going to tell you about. And so it's at her request that Janice Rao that I've introduced this bill. House Bill 3448 stipulates that when an initiative is presented to the voters calling for a tax increase on consumables, the Oregon Department of Administrative Services and Director of the Department of Revenue shall provide an estimate of state revenues, if any, that Oregon would lose if the goods are available out of state at a lower price. The bill further calls for projecting where Oregon would rank relative to other states if voters were to pass the proposed initiative. And I have already told you what inspired this bill. And prior to 1988, her business was healthy, her customer base was large and loyal. And today, her business is floundering, and a portion of her customer base has largely abandoned because they can buy the exact same high-end product via the Internet. That's great savings over what they are now required to pay in Oregon. And guess what happened and why this has come about is because of our huge cigarette tax and tobacco tax increase. And that's a commodity we all speak out against. And I'm not here upholding the virtues of tobacco, but I'm here because I think we need to be aware of what passing taxes in this state, how it impacts our businesses. When a tax is levied in Oregon on products that can be purchased on the Internet outside the state and mailed to consumers in Oregon, that takes away the competition. Her cigars now cost, and people all over you were her customers, all over the country. And now their cost is so high, maybe $12 and up for a cigar. And she just cannot compete with the Internet trade from out of state. And I believe, colleagues, that we have to do all we can to come to terms with the consequences of the Internet and consumers turning to mail order purchases from out of state companies. Information on state rankings regarding tax burdens is a matter of public record. I think that the state could project this kind of impact on revenue. And I would hope that in the future there would be consultation with retailers like Jan, who know the swings of the market on consumables that are heavily taxed in Oregon and thereby can't compete with other states. And I believe that when this information is developed, it should be included in information to the public in their while they vote on their on these measures. They need to know, they need to be informed, and then make the choice on how they will vote. And that's what this bill is all about. I had hoped that Jan could be here this evening. She was here a session ago when we were talking about extending the 10-cent cigarette tax because she was already seeing what she was being faced with by the that tax and then a far greater one. But we have some information that she has sent, and I've asked Roberta to be here. She's received this information, developed it with Jan, and I'd like Roberta to share that for you.
Thank you.
You understand what Jan has gone through.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roberta Lesperance. I'm legislative aide to Representative Lopen. And one of the reasons that Jan is not able to be here tonight is because, first of all, she's working 7 days a week now, and she's at the store tonight because she gave one of her employees the night off to enjoy his birthday. So she is still minding the store. You've received, I believe, a handout of three sheets. The first of which is a letter from Jan, and I would just like to read the final paragraph of the letter. She says, Representative Loken's bill is not about tobacco taxes, but about informing the voters of the consequences of ballot measures like this that may be put before the voters in the future. She's referring to ballot measure 44. Every state in the nation must recognize that the World Wide Web is here to stay. It gives consumers more choices and better options. They are no longer captive to their state taxing authorities. If they do not like the cost of a product due to excessive taxation of that product, they simply have to turn on their computer and go shopping. Today's consumer is voting with his or her wallet. And let me give you just a few of the impacts of this on Jan's business. During the last 2 weeks, she returned $5,500 wholesale worth of product, which means and this is product she's already paid the tobacco taxes on, but now $3,000 worth of taxes are going to be credited back to her because of the return of the product. She commented to me that nowadays when tourists come to Oregon, they bring their cigars with them. They no longer buy cigars in Oregon. She also commented, and I thought this was interesting, she said, we have presumed that we can tax all consumables the way we tax gasoline. You can't buy a gallon of gas through the mail, but there are all kinds of things that you can buy through the mail. And based on her personal knowledge of an absolutely exploding underground economy in tobacco products, both cigars and cigarettes, JAM predicts that by the end of the year 2000, we will experience a decline in the revenues collected from tobacco taxes. Now, when you think about how incredibly important those taxes are to the Oregon health plan, to other health programs that we fund, it's important not only to her and her business, but to the state as a whole, and she wants to bring that to your attention. We talk about purchase via the Internet. On the second page of the packet, you have a partial list of some of the Internet websites where you can go and buy cigars. This is only a partial list. And I asked her to please provide those for you so that you would have the opportunity.
Mr. Chair, if you're going to buy it, we thought you'd be interested to put it in specially for you. But we didn't. Did we include the prices with that?
No.
No, you'll have to come.
And on the final page, you see the story of her business in a nutshell. She compiled, and I will tell you that before she opened her own store, she was a bookkeeper in another store for 5 years. And she's a very, very aggressive and good businesswoman. You see the financial history of her business from 1994 through 1998. You look at the growth, 81%, 78%, 76%. Then you get down to 1997. The tax took effect in February of 1997. That year they had an 18% growth. And in 1998, they had a negative 11% growth. You look at the net income. It dropped by two-thirds. And then down below, she did some projections on what she realistically could have anticipated without this tax. Look at the number of employees that she anticipated having. Look at the taxes that she anticipated paying. And look at the total tax loss that she computes to the state, even if she had the business had only grown by 30% as opposed to the 72%. And that's just a tax loss from one business. She shared with me and indicated that I could pass along to you that every day folks come into her business who run neighborhood taverns. And they talk about the fact that on their back counter there's a jug of cigars. And if one of their patrons wants a cigar, they sell a cigar. And they understand that there will never be enough revenue agents in this state to track all of the places where those cigars are being sold. They've been bought from out of state without paying the taxes. They're being sold in state without paying the taxes. And the state loses, and the state programs lose, and legitimate retailers like Jan lose. She has fewer employees, and these are folks that she pays $8 to $15 an hour to her employees. So it's a compromise all the way around. And so she asks that you please consider this. One of the questions that I asked her was, what other than tobacco and perhaps wine and beer, what other possible consumable goods might at some point be targeted in this way? And in her letter, on the first paragraph of the second page, she lays out a scenario. What if the public decided to punish a manufacturer because maybe their factory conditions overseas were not what we think they should be? If it was a large manufacturer, that manufacturer could simply move their goods out of state and make them available on the Internet. We would lose jobs and we would lose tremendous tax revenue. She also anticipates that if, as she assumes, in another very few years, we experience a revenue loss from the Measure 44 taxes, what if there is a decision that we've got to tax them even higher? At that point, we would certainly hope that the information in this bill would be available to the voters before they make their decision. Early in the session, when I spoke to the Legislative Revenue Office doing some research on this bill, they had a list ranking states by the rate of taxation that they place on tobacco. I believe today Oregon ranks seventh or maybe even higher than that in the country, and there are still numerous states that have no tax at all imposed on state tax imposed at all on tobacco products. As long as that condition exists, and as long as the Internet is so accessible, we stand to, it stands to jeopardize our businesses, and it stands to jeopardize our tax revenues.
Thank you. Questions? This is Matt. Well, with all due respect, it seems to me that only one initiative out of 100 that has this kind of tax impact in Oregon. I thought someone was going to come back and reinstate the sales tax, or excuse me, establish the sales tax for initiative. Seems to me that the issue that you're raising now really would be approached best by talking about what we do to try to let all of the other states' people know that we don't have a sales tax in Oregon, and this is a great place for us to develop Internet shipments, because we could build our business economy that way, and quite realistically, I mean, this is a one hit, it's a negative. It was a test measure that probably didn't consider this impact, but I can't imagine that in the next 20 years we'll see another measure on the ballot that would have this kind of impact. On the other hand, it sounds to me like we've identified an opportunity for Oregon, which doesn't generally have a sales tax other than on cigarettes and alcohol, to develop our business with our competing states.
Mr. Chair, I'm not so sure that's true. I believe that we will probably be looking for every way possible to tax people. That's the way our tax structure seems to be going. And unless we are, every ballot that, or every measure we put on the ballot has been having a big tax impact, not just cigarettes. For instance, even the prisons. I voted for those. We all voted for those, probably. But they have, I think that in situations like that, there should be a very descriptive financial statement included on the ballot so that people do know what the impact will be. The legislature takes the blow for it. We get blamed for the taxes and the expenditures that the ballot measures bring out. But actually, I think that as we impose taxes, as we look at what we have in Oregon as compared to another state, I think that there is a big consideration that we have to make in how that is going to affect Oregon business. And I guess we're even considering that as we look at transportation and 8-mile taxes and all of those things. So, but the Internet is proving to be a very, very strong competitor in its own way.
Thank you. Further questions, Richard Loken, Roberta. Richard Loken, is there a fiscal?
Did we get a fiscal? We have not received a fiscal yet. We can find that.
Well, thank you for coming to testify. There's no one else signed up to testify on the bill.
No. Okay.
But,
all right.
So we'll give you an opportunity to visit with members of the committee and see if there's a fiscal, and then we'll...
Thank you, and we will get what we can on the fiscal.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3448 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3314. Ray Phelps and Don Levy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Loving had to leave. I'm here representing Oregonians for Maintaining Community Standards, the American Federation of State and County Municipal Employees, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 48. We are here in support of House Bill 3314. I can go through my testimony, but the bottom line is I make the analogy in my testimony that what Mr. Uren had in mind was to get the people directly involved in a legislative process. And for a long time, we in Oregon have viewed the initiative process, and I think correctly, as something special. But now I think we've kind of taken the position that it's almost extraordinary. And I think when we're looking at the legislative, I'm sorry, when we're looking at different kinds of legislative proposals that intend to deal with the initiative process, we ought to be running in our own minds parallel that this is a legislative process also. It just has a different venue. And so when you're talking about 25 signatures that can ultimately result in something getting on the ballot, and those signatures can be generated in two or three counties and never go east of the mountains, and those kinds of things, then you have a system that doesn't legislate. And so consequently, I think the 1% recommendation is an excellent recommendation. And I think the proposer of this legislation had a good idea that it also should be fair that if you go to the extent of finding those 1%, that ought to go against your required 6 or 8, whatever that number happens to be, depending on what you're proposing. I think we need to begin to view the initiative as a legislative process with a different venue. And that's my point, and I think the 1% is a very good way of demonstrating to Oregonians that the legislature believes that this is an important issue and you're sending that signal. And I think the 25 signatures is ridiculously low. And that concludes my testimony, and I'm glad to answer questions.
President Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, would say that I support House Bill 3314. Representative Devlin and myself, along with Representative Leonard and Representative Shirley, sponsored a bill that I believe, quite frankly, is word for word the same bill, and it's House Bill 3579. Mr. Chairman, it's also in the purview of this committee. I have not compared them exactly, but Representative Devlin, you can say if you think I'm right about this, but I think these are virtually word for word the same proposal, so I would have to go on record, Mr. Chairman, of supporting the proposal.
President Manning?
Well, how about compromising on something realistic, challenging, but also specific, like 1,000 signatures? That way you can't just sashay down the block and grab a few signatures and then bring something to the Capitol. You've got to be serious about it. But you don't have this percentage off. Once you start the process, you still have to go out and get the signatures to get on the ballot. If you could increase the price of admission to the antechamber, which is getting your petition going, but not make that such a difficult process, because that's where you start gathering your forces. And we could discuss later what you have to do to get into the main ballroom.
President Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Kelt. Unless they can sign as many petitions as they want to, isn't that correct?
Different petitions,
yes. Yes. So in theory, I've been here a long time today, so I just thought about this, that in theory, the 25 Democrats in the Democratic caucus could sit down right now, file 100 initiatives, promise they had something written out to file. Just the 25 of them signing every initiative, obviously they're all qualified electors, they probably need the diversity in county is necessary, et cetera.
Yeah. There's no requirement on dispersity at all,
yeah.
Which I think is ridiculous. That's another issue. But yeah, well, the Senate's talking about trying it again.
Made sense the first time.
But in reality, it's quite honestly just how the system could work now. You could bring 25 people into a room. Present 50 initiatives in front of them, have them all sign the 50 and start processing 50 initiatives.
Well, you can do that in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
The point being, though, and why I think a 1% threshold is good, is also a notice to a person seeking the petition that, boy, there's a lot of work involved here. oftentimes you kind of get a spur in your saddle and you decide you want to go do something and you get a couple friends together and you whip it up and you turn it in 25 signatures. I mean, frankly, you can get that between here and the coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you introduce somebody to the idea that there's a little more to this than just, oh, gee, that was simple, then I think all of a sudden you have communicated that, yeah, this is a valuable system. The system is an insider system now. And let's face it, it's an inside ball game, the initiative process. It's not what was established in the early 1900s. So I think the legislature ought to take the initiative, pun intended, to demonstrate and signal that there is a value to the initiative process, and this is a valuable system. It's a system that needs to be respected, and this is one of those signals and or, if you wish, indicators that this is the level of respect you need to get in to start.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colleagues, I mean, one of the things this bill is directly aimed at, frankly, is the ballot title shopping that goes on in this building. And I think it's completely reasonable to put people who are going to avail themselves of this system on record that they really need to get where they need to be with the 1%. And it allows you then to count those signatures towards your total petition amount. So they don't have to go back out and round up this 1% a second time once the petitions have been issued. They get to essentially keep these signatures. I think it's a completely reasonable approach, and I think it will put an end to the ballot title shopping, but quite frankly, it can abuse the process. And I think Mr. Phelps is absolutely right. I think the father of all these initiative systems, Mr. Uran, would be turning in his grave if he thought the process would be used as simply as not the ballot title shopping.
Representative Pearson. Thank you. Just a comment. I think it sounds really reasonable, too, and for some reason, just in terms of the accessibility of it, 1% sounds better than 1,000 signatures. I just...
The 1% like 10,000.
I know, but it sounds small just
from
that.
Less more.
I understand it's more. Just sound, it's
yeah, no, but it just sounds less, right?
Right,
yeah,
right.
I agree with that.
Uh-huh.
1%
uh-huh.
Mr. Chair, although we could call it the 1,000 signatures of Oregon. kind of a
range. It's getting late, Jim. Any other questions or comments?
Oh, okay.
Representative of Wire there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if the witness is the correct person to answer this question, or I'm trying to figure out the semantics here in the, when I'm talking about Section 7 and the measure and relating to the SMS. The SMS says it's a constitutional amendment. It's a House bill. Is it actually a constitutional amendment? I thought a constitutional amendment was proposed by the HJR.
I do this. Not wrong.
And so if it is statutory, okay, that answers my first question.
I hear the subject in now.
Okay. My next question would be, how would this affect referendums, or does it at all?
As I understood, the measure as it's drafted would only affect the initiative process, because you don't have to have a prospective petition on a referendum. You just refer the measure. I could be mistaken, but I've always viewed this as the initiative process. The ballot, seeking and obtaining the ballot title.
I got another question then.
Yeah, Representative Beyer.
Yeah. That being the case, I can see this being referred to the voters in an instant if we were to pass it in this form without the voters to vote on it. Or we could just pick an emergency clause on it.
Any other questions, Representative
Devlin? Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, since the statement was made, and I know it's been already corrected over here, it's 1% of the signatures required for a statutory or constitutional. So we're talking, I don't know what the
initiative.
Initiative. They were talking somewhere between 600 and 800 signatures.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, there is a difference. Can you clarify, you're talking about, obviously the legislature can refer, and you're talking about a referendum. In that process, how do you start that process? Because I don't honestly know. I mean, we've had one referendum in the last
I have been, I've been out of the business directly for a while, and I don't really want to step off on that. My belief is that you need to simply file a prospective petition and move forward the referendum, because you're only dealing in 90 days. So you've got to move quickly, and it's a very accelerating process.
A referendum.
A referendum is something you guys do, and then they don't like.
Any other questions? Representative Beck, you have a question?
I think I've been answered.
And then,
if I want to clarify that I, dare I say this, I initially misunderstood the 1% objection. I thought it was 1% of the electorate who voted in the last gubernatorial election, which would be more like 8,000, 10,000, whatever.
That's
1%. Ooh. So the 1% is much more reasonable in the context of the number of signatures you require. And I don't have a problem with requiring people to be serious about a particular petition. I would hope that we would also get serious about some other parts of the process, but it certainly is a reasonable way to approach this part of the process.
Is there any, with every member of the members of the committee, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify? Public hearing, House Bill 3314. Seeing none, close the public hearing on 3414.
I think House Bill 3579, which is the bill that Representative Devlin and I sponsored, that that's the exact same thing, that's been scheduled for a hearing sometime next week. So having had essentially the committee's discussion on this bill, either vehicle could be potentially used to accomplish the task.
Well, that is the option I would offer you, Representative Williams. And we had a fair airing out of the issue. We have no one here testifying in opposition. The sponsor of the bill did not show up to testify in support of it. We do have several sponsors of the right major here in the committee, so we'll give you that opportunity. A little later date.
And the sponsor of this bill is a sponsor.
Yeah, he's a co-sponsor of this. He is also a co-sponsor of our bill. So
we'll play a little politics for this. And yes, yeah. Mr. Byer.
Yeah.
I'd just like to suggest to Representative Williams that he is going to have a bill similar that he may draft an amendment that was from an emergency clause on his bill.
Anybody disagree with an emergency clause?
Well, I don't know that we want to go that far. We'll hear the other bill and we'll make a decision at that time.
If this is the value of the currency of the emergency clause, it's used for other purposes. We've got this thing not affecting petitions till the year 2000, and then we're going to put
somebody's going to clause on it. Get 60,000 signatures.
Other than the concern that someone might refer, I don't think it's highly
relevant. Okay, we're going to have open up the public hearing on House Bill 3539, and we have Mr. Garza signed up. Oregon Supreme Court would like to testify.
I know.
Waited patiently all night.
Yes, and we'll have give a short memory report on very short.
Mr. Chair and committee members, very short. House Bill 3539 directs the Secretary of State to determine if the prospective initiative measure contains two or more amendments to the Oregon Constitution. Secretary of State to instruct Chief Petitioner to remedy the conflict and direct the Supreme Court to decide to fill the ballot title and state initiative measure within 3 days. And direct the circuit court to enter judgment within 15 days. HB 3539 provides a means to expedite the process of prospective initiative measures and address the concerns of chief petitioners regarding the length of time the prospective measures delayed.
Mr. Garza.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Keith Garza. I am the staff attorney to the Oregon Supreme Court. I'm here before you today on behalf of the court. However, the court does not at this time have a position on the proposed legislation. It may have one later. I've reviewed the bill myself and also have spoken informally with several of the justices, and in light of some of the concerns that they expressed and some of the questions that I have, I'm appearing before you this evening. The bill essentially has two components. One deals with pre-election review for compliance with certain constitutional requirements, and the second component has to do with changes in the ballot title review process. Both components would impose day-specific deadlines for the Supreme Court to decide matters before it. I'm going to limit my remarks also in light of the time only to the ballot title review component. The questions that I have there, though, would, I think, apply equally, if not even more forcefully, to the pre-election review component of the legislation. Kind of an overview, and as I had explained in one of the earlier work groups, I think might be the appropriate term, the Supreme Court takes ballot title review proceedings seriously. It considers them to be real cases. In most instances, I believe 23 to 14, the initiatives in the last election cycle proposed constitutional amendments, and the court takes those matters commensurately seriously and is of the view that they should receive deliberate consideration. It takes the standard of review seriously, as is evidenced by concurring dissenting opinions. These are not rubber stamp matters. And there is a question, at least in my mind, whether, in light of the significance that the court attaches to these matters, whether they are fit for what I would call an extremely fast-track disposition before the court. My first look at this, the question I had is there a problem from the standpoint of time in the Supreme Court? And one way to look at that is review in the court keeping measures off the ballot? I've made some inquiries with the Secretary of State's office, and frankly, I don't know the answer to that question. The Secretary of State's office did not either. They could not cite any example where time in the court led to the chief petitioner not being able to obtain sufficient signatures, and I'm not aware of them myself. Monitoring kind of the motions docket for these matters, I don't see many, if any, opposition to requests for extension of time in our court for these proceedings, which suggests that that there may not be a large problem here. I'm not the expert in that area. I mainly try to help the court decide its cases, but that's from my own personal experience. The second component to the question of whether there's a problem is how the time is being allocated. I think the Secretary of State's office had provided some analysis of how much time these matters typically spend in the court, and I had, in response to that, essentially presented a timeline of what happens along the way in a given ballot title review proceeding. I won't go into that again here. I have a little outline that I'm happy to share, but I would submit that a lot of the time spent in the Supreme Court is not time where a matter is spent before the court awaiting a decision. It's time that the parties are using to brief the case. It's time that's being used to arrange the scheduling of oral argument, and there are some other time frames specifically built into the process by the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure that add to the amount of time that it takes to, kind of from a soup to nuts standpoint, resolve these matters. I guess the next question that I have is, should there be a time limit for these cases? I would note that at a minimum, there are 10 other statutorily fast-tracked matters that go to the Supreme Court, legislatively directed, expedited review in the Supreme Court. In none of those did I find a specific day deadline that the court had to make a decision. It was expeditious or moving it ahead of other cases in the docket or similar language. The closest I found is the process for certifying an appeal from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. And there, the statutes provide up to 30 days within which the court can decide whether or not to accept the certified appeal. It's not to decide the case on the merits, but whether or not it's going to allow the case to come as a matter of initial appellate review to our court as opposed to having to go through the Court of Appeals. And in addition to that, there is a default that if the court does not act on the certification within the time allotted the appeal stays in the Court of Appeals. The questions that question itself generated in my mind are, what happens if for some reason there is a time limit imposed and the Supreme Court is unable to decide the matter within 30 days? What would the effect of that be? Would the Attorney General's certified ballot title become the ballot title? Would the petitioner's proposed ballot title filed together with the petition, I think, as a matter of appellate rule, would that become the ballot title that would be used in the circulation process? And then with respect to if the body is of the mind that there should be a time limit fixed, is 30 days a sufficient amount of time? I think it's important to remember that this measure or this bill would impose a 30-day deadline within which the court must decide the matter that runs from the time that the petition itself is filed. Presently, built into the system already, it takes more than 30 days on most occasions to get the matter from petition filing to argument before the court. There's a 7-day period within which the Attorney General files an answering memo. There can be another 7 days built in if there is an intervener. Then also at the back end, we have time for allowing petitions for reconsideration. Sometimes we will make a factual mistake or simply decide a matter incorrectly because we failed to accurately understand the party's arguments. And we've built into that process a procedure where we can correct our errors if we need to. The biggest variable, obviously, in these cases is the time that the matter is before the court for decision. After it's been argued and submitted and when the court is wrestling with whether to certify it, whether to modify it, and if so, how.
Mr. Chairman?
Certainly.
Yes, Mr. Matt.
Well, first of all, I think we could deal with the whole issue about the time frame for Supreme Court review of ballot titles by simply allowing a circulator to use the certified ballot titles, as we've said before, in a work session or a work group, to circulate that petition pending Supreme Court review. Then how long the Supreme Court takes is almost moot, because once they review it, that's the ballot title that goes on the ballot. That was originally the issue. Then we said it had to go on the damn petition, and now we worry about fighting over what the words are before the petition can be circulated. If we just said it didn't have to be on the petition, or that you can use a certified ballot title and circulate the petition using that pending Supreme Court review, that becomes a non-issue. The big issue, the problem that seems to me to be addressed by this bill, is with the Armada decision, we now have the Secretary of State under his rules saying, oops, sorry, you didn't make it, you're having two impacts on the Constitution, therefore you need to have separate initiatives, in effect, if you want to cover these issues. What is your response to the idea of having a process put in place, which this bill does, and I think the most important part of the bill, so that someone, if they think the Secretary of State is wrong, can challenge it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix. And not to dodge the question, the court, I don't think at this point, has a position on the bill in that respect. Let me say this, that in my mind there is at least an issue as to whether there would be a justiciable case of controversy before the court at that point in the election cycle, a pre-election challenge to the constitutionality of...
I would think it would be a justiciable issue in the sense that while the Secretary of State may be wrong, you have to gamble on whether he's right or wrong. And the Supreme Court has now said it will invalidate voters' vote if they decide after the fact that there should have been separate initiatives for these amendments. So it seems to me, based on Armada, it is justiciable, because otherwise you're rolling the dice when the Secretary of State tells you that he thinks. In fact, you ought to be allowing review either way, because even if he says he thinks it's fine, 2 years later the Supreme Court may say, oh, sorry, that should have been true initially. So it seems to me the Supreme Court has put itself in a position with Armada saying this is justiciable because they will invalidate the vote after the fact. It's a new game, I would say.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, that argument may in fact carry the day. I would expect to see a litigant before the Supreme Court making a case or controversy argument to us.
It would help if the legislature declared that it's a case or controversy under those circumstances, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court's jurisdiction would derive from the Constitution in that instance. I think there is authority from the Supreme Court that says under Article 7, there would not be authority to decide a non-justiciable matter. And if the legislature by statute were to say that certain matters were did present cases and controversies, I think that would just beg the ultimate question of whether that was consistent with the Constitution.
Mr. Chairman, if I may,
yes.
And then we would see the catch-22 situation where you don't get to get the court to tell you ahead of time whether or not you need more than one initiative. You have to wait, circulate your petitions, get on the ballot, let the voters decide, and when they vote in favor, wait until afterwards for a ruling that, whoops, that should have been two petitions with two separate votes, and therefore the entire process is invalidated. I would think that kind of situation being such a catch-22 would cause the court to, well, otherwise, I realize you can't commit the court on that point. It seems to me that with that decision, there's a real burden on us to find a solution.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mann, to add to that, that not only do we have the Armada review issue, but also the Secretary's determination that the initiative may constitute a revision rather than amendment of the Constitution or embrace more than a single subject. Just a general observation, time-wise, if you're looking at 30 days on ballot title review proceedings, the issues are much more significant in the pre-election challenge. They are weighty matters of constitutional interpretation. I do not believe that the Supreme Court would necessarily feel itself bound by a pronouncement made in a ballot title review proceeding if the initiatives were to pass and later be challenged again on the merits before the court. However, in a pre-election context, the court would be in the position of interpreting the Oregon Constitution, and I think you would have a real problem in deciding a matter of that level of significance within a 30-day time frame. For one thing, the briefing, my major concern would be that there would be inadequate time to properly brief the matter, and in, you know, from the time that Armada was argued until it was decided, maybe some indication of how long it takes the court to wrestle with an issue like that.
Representative Manning?
Thank you. Well, then should we simply refer out an amendment to the Constitution that says it will be harmless error if the voters finally vote for something even though the Supreme Court determines that the procedure was improper?
Don't make the man crazy.
any other questions, comments of the committee? Mr. Gardner, do you have anything further to add?
I did. I know it's late.
I'm sure the committee will come back before the committee.
Very well.
If we're going to know that we can invite you back.
Thank you very much.
The committee's done good work tonight. We'll close a public hearing on the bill that we just did.
3539.
Are we going to leave? Are we agreeing? 3539.
We already heard 3539.
3539. You know other business for the committee? Okay.
Very good.
At least we're all here.